You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I recently took part in two public debates on the question of whether war can ever be justified with Pete Kilner, professor of ethics from West Point Military Academy. David Barsamian's Alternative Radio recorded the first debate, and I'm airing half of that this week and half of it next week. The videos of both debates are at davidswanson.org. We begin with Pete Kilner.
We have human rights, and the argument I'm going to make is that based on our human rights, which give rise to our communal rights, we have rights also to defend ourselves against other countries. So war is justifiable when your political community, your country, has been attacked by an aggressor nation. Let me tell you quickly about kind of how I got into this position. I grew up probably pretty much on the militarist side of things, right? So there's three broad groups. Militarists, who think war is kind of a good thing, a noble thing, mostly about national interests, they're not worried about ethics. Then you have pacifists, who say war is a horrible thing, we should never do it. And then you have the middle ground, which I'm arguing for, which is saying war can be justifiable if you're on the defending side. Right? So first, we do have a right that another human being not kill us. We do have a right that another human being not enslave us. Our right to free speech is the right that someone doesn't prevent us, coerce us from being able to speak our minds. So these core rights we all agree with, these are negative rights. These are claims against another person that says, you can't do something to me. There are other kinds of rights, positive rights. You have the right to health care. You have the right to income. Those are much more disputed because now you're saying not that someone should leave you alone. You're saying someone owes you something. But our country is based on, and the notion of human rights, traditionally, on these negative rights, the right not to be killed, not to be enslaved, the right to bodily integrity. Every human being has those by virtue of being a human being. But we also know that we can forfeit our rights. There's more than a million Americans in jail right now because they did something that forfeited their right to live freely in society. If you're walking home and someone attacks you, you just naturally know through natural law, you have the right to fight back. You'd almost be disregarding yourself if you didn't. And it's because everyone has a right, but we can forfeit our right. And when a human being threatens another human being who still possesses their right, that threatener forfeits their own right for the time during which they're a threat. And that's why if someone comes at you, you can fight back. And that's why other passerbys can come and help save you and do violence to that person because that person has forfeited their right not to be harmed because they're harming someone else. And it's, we always want to think about it. The person who is creating that threat and that harm is the person during that time who forfeits their own right. Now, the other people, think about it. They don't have to stop and help you because their rights aren't being threatened. But they do it out of love for a fellow human being. I think almost everything in morality can be understood by three big principles. Respect other people, respect their human dignity, support the common good, and love one another, right? Which is a more positive duty. So when those others come to help you, think how grateful you would be that through their love, they stopped you from being harmed. And I'll think about a police force. The police are people who say, we're not worried about just what comes to us, anyone attacking us or attacking our family or something we see. Our job is to try to prevent this behavior and to stop this behavior when we see it. The police protect us from threats inside of our political community. What the law, and based on morality, I think very well, says about when we can ever do harm to another person. Someone forfeits their right when they have the intent to do harm, the capability to do harm, and when the harm is imminent, right? They can't be running away saying, I'm going to come back and get you later. It would be wrong to shoot him in the back. Right? And so that's why for that police officer, if that police officer puts the gun on the criminal and the criminal puts up their hands, the police officer should not shoot. That's a statement that their intent is no longer threatening. Of course, they say drop the weapon, right? Because then when someone doesn't have a capability to do harm, they're no longer a threat and they regain their right not to be killed. We see the same thing in war at the individual level. Soldiers should never kill. As soon as an enemy soldier surrenders or an enemy soldier is wounded and incapacitated, it would be morally wrong to kill them. They're no longer a threat and they regain their right not to be killed. Now, I'm guessing that my colleague here, my pastor's colleague, is agreeing with the right not to be killed at an individual level and the police officer level, and they say war isn't like that. Because war is, think about it. I've been to war, deployed 5 times. Any just war should be, by just war theory, a war of last resort. A just war is a necessary war, but it's a war that if you cede, if you just give up, you can't do anything more. And we always have the right to fight to defend our political community. When Germany attacked Poland, 1939, the Polish had the right to fight to try to defend their political community. When Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990, the Kuwaitis had a right to fight back to defend their political community. Just like individuals have that right. So because a war is between these political communities, that's why you don't have to wait. I have to talk to soldiers about this. You don't have to be personally threatened. The war is between us and Al-Qaeda. Okay? The chance for talking about peace is gone. The fight is on. When you get the chance, you should kill the enemy combatants, as long as they're still combatants. Take that back to the individual case. If someone attacks you when you're walking home tonight with a knife, and you're down on the ground, and that knife is coming towards your eyeball, it would be stupid for your knee to say, well, I'm not personally threatened. I'm not going to knee him in the groin, right? No, because we're all one body, and our body has to work together. If any of us is threatened, all of us is threatened, we should all work together to end the threat. And that's how it is in war. Our political community, judged by our political leaders, they've said, we are so threatened that we have to fight. The other options aren't working. The military is the fist of the body politic. The whole rest of the body is going to suffer and die unless you fight. And that's what we do. Just like our fist does it for our own body if you get attacked tonight, the military does it for our own political community. Now, I wish the proper role in this political body is for the head to be very deliberative. And the head is our political leadership. And they should be trying to find any other way to fight. Right? In the military, our role is to win the war if our political leadership, elected by all of us, says that that's what we have to do. The thing that's missing right now, I think, within our polity is the civilian leadership and the civilian people understanding when war is just and saying we're only going to go to war when war is just. But still, I have an easy role in this argument. All I have to say is, can war be justifiable? Of course. When you are attacked, to defend yourself is justifiable. That can be a mental leap for us because no one's going to attack the United States anytime soon. We're pretty big, we're powerful, and we're protected by oceans. But I guarantee you that if United States forces were not physically present and willing to fight to defend Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, probably even Poland, Western Ukraine, Georgia, the parts that Russia hasn't already invaded, Russia would be using force to take those over. And sometimes it doesn't make sense to us. Like, why would they do that? Why don't we all just get along? There's always a minority of people throughout history, in all times, in all places, in all cultures, who won't just get along, who will violate the rights of others, violate the property rights. I've been in Iraq where there was lawlessness in 2003 when the government fell. And hey, this is your chance to all get along. This horrible dictator that was so bad to you is gone. And what did people do? They were just killing each other, right? It was massive theft. Why? Because some human beings will do bad things. And that's at the individual level, that's at the societal level, that's at the international level. And as long as you have evil in the world, you have to have some people who are willing to fight to defend against that evil.
What we just heard was mostly theoretical about unnamed wars. I would have expected a long list of examples of the wars that have been justifiable. We heard Poland and we heard the Gulf War. Last resorts. Nothing else could have been done. They were just and humane and good wars. Iraq, before the Gulf War, was willing to negotiate a peaceful settlement. It proposed that Israel also withdraw from the Palestinian territories while Iraq withdrew from Kuwait. It proposed weapons of mass destruction free zone for the Middle East. And many governments of the world encouraged pursuing those negotiations. The United States' preference was for war. There is no such thing as war as a last resort. There is going out of your way to avoid peace. And as if we can talk about actual examples of wars, I would love to hear some examples of the ones that have been justified and of the ones that haven't been justified. And I would love to know how you quantify the difference, how you determine the good that's supposedly accomplished and how many deaths are justified by that good. I would like to know how to quantify that. Pete wrote in the Washington Post in 2006 that people were blind to all the good that U.S. soldiers were doing and the war was doing for Iraq, a nation absolutely destroyed by that war. I want to know what that good was. Regardless of whether the good outweighed the bad and the war was justified or not, I'd like to know that too. But what in the world was that good? The idea that wars are somehow self-defense and that this justifies wars. I mean, that argument has to go both ways. Both sides can claim it. But if only one side gets to claim it, well, it's not this one. It's Iraq. It's Afghanistan. It's Vietnam. It's the places attacked that can more plausibly make that claim. But it doesn't justify making war. And justifying a soldier's actions within a war doesn't justify the decision to initiate a war. And a soldier is not a civilian with the right to self-defense, you know, a right that does not come because somebody else has forfeited their right. It comes most plausibly because it's actually a last resort, because they have tried nonviolent approaches, which in an individual case can run out. It's not a good analogy to a war, because the same does not apply. In war, most of the killing historically has happened while the other soldiers are retreating, including killing some 30,000 Iraqis in that good war, in that justifiable war, the Gulf War. Following an illegal order is not legal. An Iraqi village is not a threat to a drone pilot, and Iraq was never a threat to the United States. These are not facts.
I'll try to answer all your questions. Some just wars. World War II. The I-4 intervention in Bosnia. If you're not familiar with Srebrenica, look it up. When UN troops were not willing to fight, 9,000 men got slaughtered. When the United States came in, the slaughter ended. We waited 5 years and 300,000 people had to die before we ended the slaughter by going in there with military force, and the people will be forever grateful to us there in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Afghanistan, OIF-1. You know, all they had to do is turn over al-Qaeda. They decided to put in their bit with them, a foreign government that sponsors people who have declared war on you and are killing your citizens has forfeited its right as a government, not the people. Bad wars, Grenada, bad war, Panama, bad war. 80s, I guess, wasn't a good decade.
The notion that war is natural is frankly ridiculous. A great deal of conditioning is needed to prepare most people to take part in war, and a great deal of mental suffering, including higher suicide rates, is common among those who have taken part. In contrast, not a single person is known to have suffered deep moral regret or post-traumatic stress disorder from war deprivation. War does not correlate with population density or resource shortages. It is quite simply most used by those societies most accepting of it. The United States is high on and in some ways dominates the top of that list. Surveys have found the U.S. public among wealthy nations the most supportive of, quote, preemptively attacking other countries. Polls have also found that in the U.S., 44% of people claim they would fight in a war for their country, while in many other countries with equal or higher standard of living, that response is under 20%. U.S. culture is saturated with militarism, and the U.S. government is uniquely devoted to it, spending almost the same as the rest of the world combined, despite most of the other big spenders being close allies whom the U.S. pushes to spend more. In fact, every other nation on earth spends closer to the $0 spent by Costa Rica or Iceland than to the $1 trillion spent by the United States. The U.S. maintains some 800 bases in other people's countries, while all other nations on Earth combined maintain a few dozen foreign bases. Since World War II, the U.S. has killed or helped kill some 20 million people, overthrown at least 36 governments, interfered in at least 84 foreign elections, attempted to assassinate over 50 foreign leaders, dropped bombs on people in over 30 countries. For the past 16 years, the U.S. has been systematically damaging a region of the globe, bombing Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, and Syria. The U.S. has so-called special forces in two-thirds of the countries on Earth. When I watch a basketball game on TV, the announcers will thank the U.S. troops for watching from 175 countries. That's uniquely American. In 2016, a presidential primary debate question was, would you be willing to kill hundreds and thousands of innocent children? That doesn't happen in election debates in other countries where the other 96% of humanity lives. U.S. foreign policy journals discuss whether to attack North Korea or Iran. That's uniquely American. The publics of most countries polled in 2013 by Gallup called the U.S. the greatest threat to peace in the world. Pew found that viewpoint increased in 2017. So this country has an unusually strong investment in war, though it is far from the only war maker. But what would it take to have a justifiable war? According to just war theory, a war must meet several criteria, which I find fall into these three categories: the non-empirical, the amoral, and the impossible. By non-empirical, I mean things like right intention, a just cause, and proportionality. When your government says that blowing up a building where ISIS has stored money justifies killing up to 50 people, there is no agreed-upon empirical test to go out there and reply, no, it's only 49, or it's 6, or it's 4,097 people can be justly killed. Attaching some just cause to a war, such as ending slavery, never explains all the actual causes of a war and does nothing to justify the war. During a time when much of the globe ended slavery and serfdom without a war, claiming that as the cause for a war carries no weight. By amoral criteria, I mean things like being publicly declared and being waged by legitimate and competent authorities. These are not moral concerns. Even in a world where we actually had competent and legitimate authorities, they wouldn't make a war any more or less just. Does anyone really picture a family in Yemen hiding from a constantly buzzing drone, being thankful that it's been sent to them by a competent and legitimate authority? By impossible, I mean things like be a last resort, have a reasonable prospect of success, keep non-combatants immune from attack, respect enemy soldiers as human beings, treat prisoners of war as non-combatants. To call something a last resort is in reality merely to claim it is the best idea you have, not the only idea you have. There are always other ideas that anyone can think of, even if you're in the role of the Afghans or the Iraqis actually being attacked. Studies like those of Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stefan have found nonviolent resistance to domestic and even foreign tyranny to be twice as likely to succeed, and those successes to be far longer lasting. We can look to successes, some partial, some complete, against foreign invasions over the years, Nazi-occupied Denmark and Norway, in India, in Palestine, Western Sahara, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Ukraine, etc., and many dozens of successes against regimes that in many cases have had foreign support. My hope is that the more that people learn the tools of nonviolence and their power, the more they will believe in and choose to make use of that power, which will increase the power of nonviolence in a virtuous cycle. But continuing with the impossible criteria, what about respecting a person while trying to kill her or him? There are lots of ways to respect a person, but none of them exist simultaneously with trying to kill that person. In fact, I would rank right at the bottom of people who respect me, people who are trying to kill me. Remember, just war theory was created by people who believed that killing someone was doing them a favor. And non-combatants are the majority of casualties in modern wars, overwhelmingly, so they cannot be kept safe. And there is no reasonable prospect of success available. The U.S. military is on an enormous, record-breaking losing streak. But the biggest reason that no war can ever be justified is not that no war can ever meet all the criteria of just war theory, but rather that war is not an incident. It is an institution. Many people in the U.S. will concede that many U.S. wars have been unjust, but claim justness for World War II or Bosnia or a couple others. Others claim no just wars yet, but join the masses in supposing that there might be a justifiable war someday. It is that supposition, far more than any wars, that kill people. The U.S. government spends over $1 trillion on war and war preparations each year, while 3% of that could end starvation, and 1% of it end the lack of clean drinking water globally. The military budget is the only place with the resources needed to try to save the Earth's climate. Far more lives are lost and damaged through the failure to spend money well than through the violence of war. And more are lost or put at risk through side effects of that violence than directly. War and war preparations are the biggest destroyer of the natural environment. Most countries on Earth burn less fossil fuels than does the U.S. military. Most Superfund disaster sites, even in this country, are at military bases. The institution of war is the biggest eroder of our liberties, even when the wars are marketed under the word freedom. This institution impoverishes us, threatens the rule of law, degrades our culture by fueling violence, bigotry, the militarization of police and mass surveillance. This institution puts us all at risk of nuclear disaster, and it endangers rather than protects those societies that engage in it. According to the Washington Post, President Trump asked Secretary of so-called Defense James Mattis why he should send troops to Afghanistan, and Mattis said, to prevent a bomb in Times Square. Yet the man who tried to set off a bomb in Times Square 7 years ago said it was to get the U.S. troops out of Afghanistan. For North Korea to try to occupy the United States would require a force many times larger than the North Korean military. For North Korea to attack the United States, were it actually capable, would be suicide. Could it happen? Well, look at what the CIA said before the U.S. attacked Iraq. Iraq would be most likely to use its weapons only if attacked. Apart from the non-existence of those weapons, that was accurate. Terrorism has predictably increased during the war on terrorism, as measured by the Global Terrorism Index. 99.5% of terrorist attacks occur in countries engaged in wars and or abuses such as imprisonment without trial, torture, or lawless killing. The highest rates of terrorism are in so-called liberated and democratized Iraq and Afghanistan. The terrorist groups responsible for the most terrorism, that is, non-state politically motivated violence around the world, have grown out of U.S. wars against terrorism. Those wars themselves have caused numerous just retired top U.S. government officials and a few U.S. government reports to describe military violence as counterproductive, as creating more enemies than are killed. 95% of all suicide terrorist attacks are conducted to encourage foreign occupiers to get out of the terrorist's home country. And an FBI study in 2012 said that anger over U.S. military operations abroad was the most commonly cited motivation for individuals involved in cases of so-called homegrown terrorism in the U.S. These facts lead me to three conclusions. One, foreign terrorism in the United States could be virtually eliminated by keeping the U.S. military out of any country that is not the United States. Two, if Canada wanted anti-Canadian terrorist networks on a U.S. scale or just wanted to get threatened by North Korea, it would need to radically increase its bombings, occupying, and base construction around the world. Three, on the model of the war on terrorism, the war on drugs that produces more drugs, the war on poverty that seems to increase poverty, we would be wise to consider launching a war on sustainable prosperity and happiness. For a war on North Korea to be justifiable, for example, the U.S. would have to have not gone to such efforts over the years to avoid peace and provoke conflict. It would have to be innocently attacked. It would have to lose the ability to think so that no alternatives could be considered. It would have to redefine success to include a scenario in which a nuclear winter might cause much of the Earth to lose the ability to grow crops or eat. By the way, Keith Payne, a drafter of the new Nuclear Posture Review back in 1980, parodying Dr. Strangelove, defined success to allow 20 million Americans dead and unlimited non-Americans dead. It would also have to invent bombs that spare non-combatants. It would have to devise a means of respecting people while killing them. And in addition, this remarkable war would have to do so much good as to outweigh all the damage done by decades of preparing for such a war, all the economic damage, political damage, damage to the Earth's land, water, and climate, all the deaths by starvation and disease that could have been so easily spared, plus all the horrors of all the unjust wars that were facilitated by the preparations for the dreamed-of just war, plus the risk of nuclear apocalypse created by the institution of war. No war can meet such standards. So-called humanitarian wars, which is what Hitler called his invasion of Poland and NATO called its invasion of Libya, do not, of course, measure up to just war theory, but neither do they benefit humanity. What the U.S. and Saudi militaries are doing to Yemen is the worst humanitarian disaster in years. The U.S. sells or gives weapons to 73% of the world's dictators and gives military training to many of them. Studies have found that there is no correlation between the severity of human rights abuses in a country and the likelihood of Western invasion of that country. But other studies have found that oil-importing countries are 100 times more likely to intervene in civil wars of oil-exporting countries. And in fact, the more oil a country produces or owns, the higher the likelihood of third-party interventions. The U.S., like any other war maker, has to work hard to avoid peace. The U.S. has spent years rejecting out-of-hand peace negotiations for Syria. In 2011, so that NATO could begin bombing Libya, the African Union was prevented by NATO from presenting a peace plan to Libya. In 2003, Iraq was open to unlimited inspections or even the departure of its president, according to numerous sources, including the president of Spain, to whom U.S. President Bush recounted Hussein's offer to leave. In 2001, Afghanistan was open to turning Osama bin Laden over to a third country for trial. In 1999, the U.S. State Department deliberately set the bar too high, according to members of the U.S. State Department, insisting on NATO's right to occupy all of Yugoslavia so that Serbia wouldn't agree and would therefore supposedly need to be bombed. Go back through history. The United States sabotaged peace proposals for Vietnam. The Soviet Union proposed peace negotiations before the Korean War. Spain wanted the sinking of the USS Maine to go to international arbitration before the Spanish-American War. Mexico was willing to negotiate the sale of its northern half. In each case, the U.S. preferred war. Peace would not seem so difficult if people stopped going to such efforts to avoid it, like Mike Pence in a room with a woman from North Korea trying not to indicate awareness of her presence. And if we stopped letting them scare us, fear can make lies and simplistic thinking believable. We need courage. We need to lose this fantasy of total safety that drives us to create ever greater danger. And if the United States had a democracy rather than bombing people in the name of democracy, I wouldn't have to convince you all of a thing. The U.S. public already favors military reductions and greater use of diplomacy. Such moves would stimulate a reverse arms race, and that would open more eyes to the possibility of advancing further in that direction, the direction of what is required by morality, what is necessary for the habitability of our planet, what we must pursue if we are to survive, the complete abolition of the institution of war.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, AT&T and Time Warner are two global corporate powerhouses who will soon be one global corporate powerhouse. After a ruling by a district court judge didn't just pave the way for their mega merger, but virtually strew their path with flowers. It's true the government didn't make much of a case, and it's true that the judge doesn't seem to understand how the internet works. But the deeper truth may be that we need to fundamentally rethink our antitrust approaches to the media tech industry that is every day more influential. We'll talk with technology journalist Nilay Patel of The Verge about that. Also on the show, a case doesn't have to be won to have impact. Witness federal prosecutors' strenuous effort to put someone in prison for protests at Donald Trump's inauguration. Charges were just dropped against another group of so-called J20 activists. But just because the state's case is unraveling and elite journalists don't care about it, doesn't mean the effort to criminalize constitutionally protected activity doesn't matter. We'll catch up on the J20 case with Sam Menefee-Leiby, an organizer and member of the D.C. Legal Posse. That's coming up, but first, a quick look back at recent press. A few things about Virginia Republican Senate candidate Corey Stewart. He described as one of my personal heroes, Wisconsin congressional candidate and self-described pro-white Christian Paul Nehlen, who suggests deporting all Muslims and whose overt and various hatreds have led Breitbart to break ties with him, along with a Twitter ban. Stewart joined his endorser Jason Kessler at a rally for Kessler's group Unity and Security for America last year. Kessler, of course, the organizer of the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally, with the Nazi salutes and the blood and soil chanting and the murder of counter-protester Heather Heyer. After the rally, Stewart declared there was, quote, no reason to apologize, close quote. A self-described proud Southerner who was born and raised in Duluth, Minnesota, Corey Stewart has declared the Confederate flag, quote, what makes us Virginia? And if you take that away, we lose our identity, close quote. In recent tweets, Stewart describes children crying for their parents at the border as leftist terrorism props and calls for no amnesty of any sort. Corey Stewart just won the Virginia GOP Senate primary. And the Washington Post's response was an editorial headlined, quote, Corey Stewart's win in Virginia means further degradation of civic discourse, close quote. Yeah, that's the problem, discourse. In an exemplar of elite media mealy-mouthing, the Post defines and laments Stewart's embrace of white supremacist ideas and the people who act on them, not as him being a white supremacist, but as courting white supremacists. His racist comments are not him being a racist, but his seeing pandering to racism as a valuable tactic. Well, nowhere do the Post editorialists explain whence they derive the requisite insight into Stewart's soul to distinguish between his mere calculations and his true beliefs. Much less do they advise the black, brown, Muslim, Jewish, and other people at the sharp end of such courting and pandering as to how they might best appreciate the distinction. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. When News Corp wanted an FCC waiver to allow it to take over another TV station owner here in New York years ago, the story was that a merged company would be stronger and even serve news market diversity by keeping alive News Corp's daily paper, the New York Post. The merger's actual effect was better reflected in a bus ad I saw some time later advertising Ricky Lake, now on two stations. The thing is, most people don't take corporations' promises about the benefits of mergers at face value, perhaps especially in media. Concerns about the concentration of power in a few hands are keen, and one would think almost automatic. But U.S. District Court Judge Richard Leon is not most people. Leon has just ruled that the merger of AT&T and Time Warner may proceed, rejecting antitrust concerns presented by the Department of Justice. And indeed, Leon says the giant telecom carrier and the giant media company can merge with no conditions whatsoever. The ruling is weird, bad, and important. And worth understanding, our next guest says, for anyone who cares about how the government might restrain the power of giant media and tech companies. Technology journalist Nilay Patel is editor-in-chief and co-founder of The Verge. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Nilay Patel.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there are strata to this. There is the case the Justice Department might have made, and some say this maybe wasn't a good deal for the state to focus on to address antitrust concerns. Then there's the case the Justice Department did make, and then there's the judge's ruling, both its likely impact in the real world and its rationales, which are, let's say, concerning. As you note, very few people are going to plow through this 170-page opinion, but you did. What do you think is most important for us to know about what's in it?
The ruling is particularly strange, and Judge Leon seems very excited about the prospect of AT&T owning Time Warner. But I think the main thing for people to understand is that legacy media companies like Time Warner are terrified of Google and Facebook and Netflix, and they're particularly terrified because typically, if you're the CEO of HBO, your relationship to the end consumer is mediated by a cable company. So you want to buy HBO, you call Spectrum Cable, you get HBO, HBO sells the content to Spectrum, Spectrum sells the package to you. Netflix has bypassed that. They sell you a direct subscription to Netflix. Google and Facebook have bypassed that, right? You have a direct relationship with Google and Facebook. Google and Facebook also own gigantic advertising businesses, which are directly threatening channels like CNN, which rely on an enormous amount of advertising revenue. So from Time Warner's point of view, they needed to get closer to the consumer. The argument the government did not make and that Judge Leon did not even address was the fact that Netflix and Google and Facebook are all extremely reliant on our internet providers to reach the consumer. So if AT&T decides to block Netflix tomorrow, Netflix's power over HBO goes away, right? They simply just cannot reach you. And the government did not point that out, saying, if AT&T buys Time Warner and starts to prioritize HBO, Netflix will be disadvantaged in a significant way. They did not say if they start to bundle CNN for free with AT&T data plans, then that will obviously disadvantage MSNBC and Fox. And today, literally today, AT&T rolled out its new television package called AT&T Watch. It will be preloaded on AT&T phones. And indeed, you'll be able to watch CNN for free on AT&T phones as part of your data plan. And all other video will cost you money against that data plan. So there's this very obvious anti-competitive effect that will occur because AT&T now owns video that it will give you for free, and other video services will hit your data cap and you will effectively have to pay for them. The government, I think, was not able to really make this argument because that is fundamentally the net neutrality argument. Mm-hmm. And so the DOJ cannot make the net neutrality argument while at the same time Trump's FCC is tearing down net neutrality. And I think that conceptual knot was the one the judge might have been able to untie, and he basically just declined to even think about it.
Well, that's really, really interesting because, yeah, the surface thing that we heard was AT&T is a distributor, Time Warner is a content producer, so therefore their merger isn't anti-competitive because they're not reducing the number of players on their particular level. But that's a very shallow understanding of an anti-competitive effect.
And that's the standard model. I think that standard model has worked as well as it's worked for 40 years, and there has not been a DOJ lawsuit to block a vertical merger of this type using that model for 40 years, as the judge notes. I think where it becomes very difficult is the lack of competition in internet service in this country is acute. So there's only four national wireless providers. If you are looking for wired internet service, over half of the country actually only has one or two choices for wired internet service. So as these companies become bigger and bigger and bigger, their incentives to bundle their own content into their internet packages gets higher and higher and higher. And you, as a consumer, have less and less choice to get away from those bundles. So at the same time AT&T is buying Time Warner, Verizon has bought the Huffington Post and AOL and Yahoo, and they're going to bundle their Go 90 service into Verizon data plans. And they're explicit about this. They're going to install ad tracking technology that AOL has built at a pretty high level and use it across their network of Verizon products and devices, Yahoo Fantasy Football and HuffPost Live and, you know, the millions of websites AOL owns, to create an ad tracking network that can compete with Google and Facebook. And they're going to use the location data of the phones. AT&T, when they talk about Time Warner, they talk a little bit about preserving the value of CNN and making sure it keeps its journalist integrity and the, you know, the great HBO shows that everybody loves. But they also very explicitly talk about needing to build an ad network that can compete with Google and Facebook. And I think that is the piece of this puzzle that it seems to go unremarked upon, except when Judge Leon in his decision talks about how interesting it could be and how innovative it could be if the advertising was more personalized than AT&T devices, which to me, if you've experienced personalized advertising on mobile phones, does not seem very exciting because it's often very bad. But that's where we've arrived.
Exactly. Well, and the Dallas Morning News in the piece headlined "Merger May Mean More Choices for Consumers," you know, may mean, I guess it may mean cupcakes rain from the sky also, you know, but even within that, they mention targeted ads as one of the things the new company may serve up for consumers, you know, as though that's really something that consumers are waiting for with bated breath. But I wanted to ask you about media coverage of media mergers like this, because we see no shortage of stock market impact reports, you know, and then for everybody else, the angle is one that I saw in a local daily. How will the marriage of the two companies affect your binge-watching abilities? And, you know, it's not that the end user, what's going to happen when I turn on my device, you know, that's an angle, of course. But the consumer as citizen piece seems to be largely missing. And not even the bromides that we used to get, you know, where there'd be a story of a merger and there'd be a quote somewhere in there, something, something public interest, you know. These companies are shaping our social and our political interactions. It just seems to warrant more scrutiny from the media itself than it's getting.
Well, look, if you are a conservative and you watch Fox News, I'm confused, but let's say that you are doing that, you should be troubled by the fact that AT&T is going to start preloading CNN on every single one of its Android phones and giving away for free, and Fox consumers will have to effectively pay against their data plan. That should concern you. It should actually concern everybody that one major news network will now be prioritized on AT&T devices and all the other ones will not. What I think is also true, and you brought this up a little bit ago, the classic merger analysis has been a consumer benefit analysis, and the way that you measure consumer benefit is, do we think this merger is going to drive prices up? Right. If we reduce competition in the market, the incentive to raise prices will go up because there's less competition to drive prices down. And the real problem in a lot of cases, with, in particular the tech industry, is that prices are already free. So it's very hard to look at AT&T saying, we're going to buy this company and give you things for free and plug it into that analysis, because prices can't go lower than free. And I think the public interest analysis of, are we making sure this market is actually competitive? If everything's free, there's still other ways to measure competition. Are we making sure that other people have access to the market? If AT&T is one of four carriers and they're by far the largest carrier, are we confident that other people have access to the consumers that rely on AT&T for connectivity? And I think we're now at a point where both on the left and the right, there is a lot of interest in rethinking our antitrust law to account for competitiveness instead of simply price. And price as a proxy for competitiveness works when there are prices, and it obviously fails when things are trending to free. And I think that the long history of the internet is we give things away for free. And so it is time, and I think you are seeing this again, both on the left and the right, a rethinking of how we should apply our antitrust law.
Well, this wasn't the right case, but I hardly think that the lesson that the DOJ is going to take or that anyone is going to take is, well, let's go back and find the right case and do this again right now. You know?
Yeah, AT&T only buys Time Warner once in a lifetime. Right?
Yeah. And I really do think we have to find a new, from the reporting angle, we have to find a new consumer angle that isn't just, you know, I found this five things to know, this explainer that ran. And number one, you likely won't pay more, you know.
Yeah.
Number three, more intense competition could equal lower costs down the road. You know, two of the five are, it's not going to cost you more. And that frame has to shift.
If you're interested in it, it has two names. One is a fuddy-duddy academic name and the other one is the fun name. But the fuddy-duddy academic name is the New Brandeis Movement for Antitrust.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bunch of conferences, the Open Markets Institute is all over it. And the other name that people are using is called Hipster Antitrust because all of the proponents are basically young people who look cool. And it's a growing movement. I mean, there's been, just in the past year, The Economist has touched on it. The Nation has touched on it. BuzzFeed just went to a conference where the CEO of News Corp was arguing with the head of the antitrust division about that. I run a consumer technology publication. It's crazy to me that I have an audience that wants to know about antitrust. But really, the answer to how do you regulate Amazon when they are constantly pushing prices lower is fascinating.
We've been speaking with Nilay Patel. You can read his piece, The Court's Decision to Let AT&T and Time Warner Merge is Ridiculously Bad, at TheVerge.com. Nilay Patel, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners know that Washington, D.C. police mass arrested more than 200 people, including journalists, during protests at Donald Trump's inauguration, in which a few windows were broken and a limousine set on fire. Federal prosecutors have surprised some by vigorously pursuing felony riot charges against some of the so-called J20 protesters, resulting in decades of prison time. Even those they acknowledge engaged in no damage or violence, but were simply present, and in some cases, reporting. Perhaps the only hopeful part of what seems a clear effort to criminalize dissent is that the wheels seem to be coming off it. Joining us now to bring us up to date is Sam Menefee-Leiby, an organizer and member of the Dead City Legal Posse, a community group that's come together to support J20 protesters. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Sam Menefee-Leiby.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Unicorn Riot reports that a jury has just found another defendant not guilty on all but a riot charge, which the judge essentially dropped with a mistrial when the jury deadlocked. We've seen other jury acquittals. We've seen charges dropped. How many J20 defendants remain at this point, and what do you make of the current status of the government's case against them?
So there are 44 defendants still facing trial. There are currently two defendants awaiting a verdict on a trial that started May 14th. At the beginning of the show, you noted that a limo was set on fire on Inauguration Day. That actually happened 5 hours after the anti-fascist, anti-capitalist march was kettled. So it was an unrelated incident. And that's been sort of an ongoing question, especially with media coverage. Many stories, and especially mainstream media, have used the limo fire as a sort of splash page. And it doesn't have anything to do with this particular case. So, I mean, the cases, I think, are looking good right now. There have definitely been some positive developments over the past 3 weeks from the Chief Justice Robert Morin of the D.C. Superior Court finding that there was an ongoing Brady violation by the U.S. Attorney's Office in withholding dozens of videos with exculpatory value from the defense for over a year. That led to the dismissals of charges for 10 defendants and dismissals with prejudice on the conspiracy charges, as well as an order by the Chief Justice that the U.S. Attorney's Office could not proceed with the theory of the case based on Pinkerton liability, which would make it much harder to engage in the sort of blanket prosecution they've been doing. So things are looking up right now, but they're far from over. Unfortunately, there were four defendants who were in the middle of their trial when that Brady violation was found, and the evidence from the videos from Project Veritas that were the subject of the Brady violation had already been shown in court to the jury. There weren't really any corrective measures for that. And so two of the defendants who are awaiting verdicts from a jury right now are set up in a difficult position, having known that there was this Brady violation, that there was this extraordinary development of the case that wound up not yet having an impact on their trial, and their lives are in the jury's hands.
Well, I'm going to draw you out a little bit on, we're calling it a Brady violation. It means when the prosecutors withheld evidence that could have been exculpatory. In this case, we're talking about elements from a video from a group. You said it quickly. I'm not sure if folks remember Project Veritas. This is a group we know about. This is, you might call them an entrapment group. They're known for sort of sleazily editing videos to put forth their particular point of view. But what, if you could tell us, what is the bit that they cut out of the video that was presented to the jury, and why did it matter?
Yeah, so the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Metropolitan Police Department have, throughout the entire duration of this case, over the past 17 months, used a bunch of videos from right-wing sources, including Project Veritas, the Oath Keepers, the Media Research Center, Rebel Media, and others. Project Veritas is known especially for editing videos, yet the lead detective on the case, Detective Gregory Pemberton, admitted that he never looked into whether or not the footage that they received from Project Veritas was edited in any way, that they had no reasons to believe that it was. They made two small edits on their own, is what they represented to the court repeatedly for over a year. And it turned out that they'd actually lopped off a more significant portion at the beginning and end of the video. That included conversations between the Project Veritas person and multiple others after the meeting in question, and then a discussion that the Project Veritas person had with someone on the phone saying they don't know about any of the upper echelon stuff. The defense talked to this person who recorded these videos, and he said that he had no indication that anyone was planning violence, which is the reason that the prosecution claimed that video was significant. So that's the gist of that particular video. There are also 69 additional recordings that the prosecution withheld from defense counsel. And again, both the U.S. Attorney's Office and the MPD exhibited a remarkable lack of curiosity about the veracity and authenticity and reliability of the information that they got from Project Veritas. And actually, during the first trial, the day that the prosecution chose to show that video from Project Veritas was the same day that Washington Post released a story about Project Veritas trying to sting them with a fake Roy Moore victim. So that was an interesting confluence of events for the first trial.
Well, I'm going to bring you back to media coverage and that linking the protests to violence and the defendants to violence, even when in many instances that's not the case that the state is trying to make. They will say, we don't have any evidence that this person broke a window. And that's been part of the problem with the whole thing, is they are saying, but they were there, or they were dressed like people who we think may have been engaged in something. But they've acknowledged really from the beginning that the burning limousine had nothing to do with the people who were arrested. It's the media who've gotten that wrong.
The media coverage of this case from the beginning has been sloppy when it's been present at all. There were notable stories from the Washington Post, from USA Today, from CNN, and several others that tried to link the burning limo to the defendants, and then were sort of very cavalier about not issuing corrections or issuing very minor corrections when they were called on that. The Washington Post, actually, the editorial board, released an op-ed late last summer saying that no one should have any sympathy for these defendants and that it wasn't worth paying attention to. That was a real drag from the hometown newspaper here, but certainly not surprising based on the Washington Post's track record in recent years.
I found this fascinating. The New York Times on December 22nd of last year referred to a group that, quote, cut a violent swath through 16 blocks of the city, smashing windows of businesses, tossing newspaper boxes into the street, and and damaging a car, close quote. Now, the Washington Post, on January 19th of this year, in a story about J20, referred to a group who, quote, cut a violent swath through 16 blocks of the city, smashing businesses' windows, tossing newspaper boxes into the street, and damaging a limousine, close quote. Now, when I see that degree of laziness, I guess both of them were working off a state press release of some sort, though neither attributed it. Both reporters used it as though it was their own words. That laziness is indicative, as you've just said, of the disinterest that corporate media have shown toward this case. You know, the New York Times editorialized against the DreamHost data dragnet, you know, when prosecutors were trying to get info on anybody who looked at the Disrupt J20 website. But you sensed that the paper was making a distinction between the innocent people who might get caught up in that dragnet and those who were charged, who at the time still included photojournalist Alexei Wood, you know, a journalist. You would hope that they would at least identify with their own. But when the charges were dropped against Woods, the Times reported that under a headline, "Journalist charged with rioting an inauguration day protest goes free." You know, nowhere did we see a vigorous defense of protest, of dissent, much less of reporting on dissent from the very folks we would look for it from.
Yeah, I mean, Fair's own Adam Johnson has done really good work looking at how corporate media tend to just reprint state press releases from prosecutors and cops with only minor alterations and call it news. I think that that's happened a lot in this case. There are a lot of things at stake in this case, and there are very interesting origins of it, and then a lot of other things. The riot statute that's being used in this case was passed by Congress before D.C. got so-called home rule. It was actually passed in response to the uprisings in Detroit and Newark in 1967. This is an effort to sort of bring back an old racist law to prosecute dissenters in the 21st century. There's also been a huge amount of work done by community activists in D.C. for years around police brutality and the practices of MPD that we've seen linked to this case. Some, yesterday there was a story from journalist Sam Adler-Bell talking about a police witness in this trial who wore a shirt joking about police brutality and had actually been the instigator in a very disturbing incident of police brutality against a family in 2008. So, you know, I think that there are a lot of things that are happening here, questions about the First Amendment, which, of course, the New York Times loves and the Washington Post loves, but they're not digging into those questions here.
We've been speaking with Sam Menefee-Leiby, organizer with the D.C. Legal Posse. Their website's dclegalposse.org, but you can also follow this case at rightsanddissent.org and unicornriot.ninja. Sam Menefee-Leiby, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a newsletter called Extra. For subscription information, you can check out FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
You hear about a crashing ecosystem, from climate disruption to disappearing species and landscapes. What to do? There are two options: try to organize social change or attempt to escape to a safer place. In this show, you will hear a bit of both. From 3CR Radio in Australia, Vivian Langford explores personal carbon rations with Tina Fawcett. She's the author of the book Suicidal Planet. Then California permaculture podcaster Diego talks with Canada's permi guru Rob Avis, how to find an anti-fragile place to live. Welcome to Radio EcoShock, where the search goes on.
Radio EcoShock.
Vivian Langford produces and hosts the Beyond Zero Emissions radio program on 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia. 3CR broadcasts Radio EcoShock every week as well. I'm going to play you the first half of a program as Vivian talks with Tina Fawcett. Here is Vivian on 3CR.
And everything can change.
Tonight's show is about carbon rations and sort of big picture thinking. I've got really powerful thinkers from England. Tina Fawcett's in Oxford, and she was part of a British government inquiry into carbon rations. The British government thought, we'll look into the feasibility of it. You know, they'd rationed petrol, for example, in the Second World War, and it's a big thing to roll it out, but it is a way of making sure everyone gets enough of a commodity and that you don't overdose on things, you don't do it excessively. Right. And it's like a Mikey card that tells you how much you've got left each month of your carbon allowance. But then the British government said, well, this is an idea before its time, you know, we're not going to do it just yet. But I think we should still have this. It's a concept that she calls it carbon allowances rather than carbon rations. And we still need to get the carbon down, especially Australians with a much bigger carbon footprint, say, than Europeans.
Dr. Tina Fawcett has pursued the topic of personal carbon allowances in many articles and in the book The Suicidal Planet. The UK government committee, which looked into it, found that carbon rationing could become essential, but the government said it was an idea before its time. But how would it work? Would it be forever? And would it hurt? We have to think about the reasons that we have to do this, and we've got someone from Oxford University here. So Dr. Fawcett is here by Skype, and I'd like to welcome you to the Beyond Zero Emissions show, Tina.
Thank you.
I would like more people to become carbon literate, you know, to share the burden of climate change that a lot of people do feel, but not everyone. And I think that it would spark innovation, and people would demand rapid decarbonisation from each other as well as from our leaders. So tell us, why do you like the idea of carbon rations and allowances?
I think there's two main reasons, really. One is it focuses us very much on what our global carbon budget is, and it sets a cap, and it says that's got to reduce year on year, I mean, as international negotiations are doing. But this is a mechanism that brings it right down to the personal level. And so it sort of connects us with this global issue in a very tangible way. The second thing I really like about it is that it's equitable. I mean, you can argue about different interpretations of equity, but what it says is everybody's got an equal right to emit carbon emissions within this budget. And so it's not saying if you're rich, you necessarily can, you know, as of right, can emit a lot more. If you're poor, you just have to emit a lot less. It's starting off by saying everybody's got the same rights to this sort of scarce resource of the amount of carbon we can still emit and live within a safe planet. So those are the two key things, really, the effectiveness of the decreasing cap, making it personal and, well, I suppose that's three things, and making it equitable.
Yeah, tell us how it works.
Okay, so how it would work is it wouldn't cover all the carbon in the economy for people, or the simplest version is it would cover your personal travel. So possibly not by public transport, but certainly by car. It would cover your home energy use and it would cover flying. So you would have an annual amount of carbon credits or whatever they get called in your account. And when you paid for your petrol or diesel at the petrol station or when you paid your electricity bill, you'd have to have carbon credits deducted from your account as well as the money. If you didn't have any carbon credits left, if you'd already, you know, bought a lot of energy that year or had a sort of overseas flight or two, you would be able to buy additional carbon credits on the market from people who sold them who didn't need all of them. It's not really a parallel currency, but it's a little bit like that in that you have to think about both the money and whether you've got any carbon allowances left to spend that year. And if not, are you prepared to pay the price to get more?
Well, at the moment, I think it's not very easy to find out what the carbon content of an activity is. For example, just recently I took a ferry from the Australian mainland to Tasmania, and not even the captain could tell me what the carbon footprint of that ticket was. And I wonder, do you think we need to start with that information on every ticket and on every petrol bowser?
Yes, I think that's a very good idea. People often talk about how if you were going to bring this idea in, first people have to understand what the impacts of their choices are, where carbon, the sort of big carbon emissions from their everyday choices are coming. So certainly having carbon on, yeah, that's right, at petrol stations, at filling stations, having carbon on your energy bill when you get your energy bill at home, having carbon on your airline ticket. And some of those things happen now. So quite a lot of airlines will sell you a carbon offset, which is kind of a different story, I guess. But there are some forms of energy are quite easy to translate into carbon. But I think you're right, particularly ferries, it's very difficult actually to work out what the carbon impact is.
Well, I'm going to follow that story with that captain because, you know, he said he would talk to me about it. But I just think that we must be able to get on top of that sort of calculation. It's not rocket science, surely. Look, about carbon allowances, do you envisage like a trial period when people would get a free carbon allowance or an app on their phone and their house and travel carbon would be clearly displayed, and then after that year they would not be able to buy more than the average amount unless they paid more, and then it would ratchet down the next year and ratchet down so that eventually you'd be having a very small carbon allowance? Is that how...
Yes, I mean, I think you've described it extremely well. That's the sort of thing we would imagine, that there would be to be a learning period with no penalties for everybody, when everybody can get the hang of what is this new system, what does it mean to me, what choices am I going to make? And then you would gradually bring in, you know, keep moving the budget down year on year, because after all, that's the point of the scheme, is to reduce our carbon emissions as a society. Mm. And we need to do that by some mechanism, and this is one way to do it. It's not the only way, but I think it's quite an important idea to discuss.
It is an important idea to discuss, but I can't get anyone to discuss it because I think they think that pandemonium would break out if they couldn't do the things that they now are very accustomed to doing. Even though they say they care about climate change, they really don't want to forswear anything.
No, I mean, it's tricky, isn't it? But not we all, but if you look at public opinion surveys, most people are in favour of doing something about climate change. It doesn't mean they're in favour of not, you know, making that rather nice overseas trip that they wanted to make. And it's a challenge to all of us to sort of have to reconcile our ideas and our hopes for the future with our current behaviour. On the other hand, I mean, some things you can change really easily and reduce your carbon emissions, particularly on the home energy side. There's lots of technologies. There's lots of changes in decisions about what temperature you set your air conditioning or your heating at that can actually make quite a big difference with a very small impact on your lifestyle. If anything, your lifestyle is going to be better in a more efficient home because it's going to be warmer, less damp, you know, just a more pleasant place to live. So there are some win-wins out there, as well as the more tricky ones where actually you will have to lose something if you're living a lower carbon lifestyle.
That's good. But what about, there's a problem of equity here, of course. How would you smooth out this system for people who are renting or cannot afford to insulate their home, or people who need to drive a lot for their work or for their other responsibilities, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is challenging. And there's some researchers in the UK, the Centre for Sustainable Energy, did quite an extensive modelling exercise looking at people's carbon emissions across transport and housing by income group and by location, and looked at how many, what they called was sort of low income losers, there would be under a system of equal allowances. And what you find is most low income people, do better because their emissions are lower. It's the higher income people tend to have higher emissions on average. But of course, not everybody is average. And they found about 20% of the lowest, the people with the 30% of lowest incomes in the UK would actually lose out under this system. In other words, their carbon emissions are currently higher than what their allowance would be. And that's usually because they're living, as you said, rurally. They've got to travel further. There aren't public transport options for them. Or they're living in uninsulated homes that are hard to heat. And so naturally they have a higher carbon footprint, even if they're not very warm, because all their heat is going out of the walls and the roof. There isn't a simple answer to that. I think that the real answer is the sort of infrastructure that the government provides and society provides, enabling people to make lower carbon choices. And that's easiest in housing, and it's more difficult in transport, I think.
Right. Well, is it true that the British government committee who looked into the carbon allowance scheme decided that it was an idea before its time? And I'd like to know, what were their main objections?
Yes, that's right. It got quite a lot of political attention very early in its life as an idea, when there was really very little research base. So they commissioned some research from various people, and that's right. Although they found a lot good to say about the idea, their two main objections they had was, one, they said it wouldn't be public acceptability they were concerned about, and the second one was what it would cost. Now, to speak about public acceptability, there's been quite a lot of studies, most of them quite small, on what people think of this as an idea. And it depends what you compare it with, really. If you compare it with doing nothing, people would rather do nothing. If you compare it with something like a carbon tax, generally people would prefer a personal carbon allowance. So it's all about how you frame the questions, really. It's not to say there would be no objections, of course there would, but it's what you compare it with, what are your other choices. On cost, yeah, I mean, the government came up with a figure, some other researchers came up with a figure that was half of that. As we know, I mean, those were 10 years ago. We've all got a lot more used to sort of all sorts of mobile apps, mobile banking, all sorts of sort of information exchange systems. And really, under personal carbon trading, you're exchanging very small amounts of information. It's only carbon when you pay bills or buy air travel or buy petrol or diesel. So I don't think the costs are a main issue. I think it's probably the politics, the public acceptability, and what people think about equity that are the main issues.
This is Radio EcoShock with our guest host Vivian Langford on 3CR Community Radio in Australia. And later, we'll be talking about permaculture.
Well, I think one of the elements in the politics, at least in Australia, where our government's constantly getting into power every time, praying for jobs and growth, more jobs, everything has to be consumed. You know, we are praised for being consumers. And I think there's a belief that if you suppress demand in the economy on anything, transport or overseas flights, tourism or, you know, even heating and cooling the house, that the economy will stagnate or collapse, and people feel that they're actually doing a good thing by flying away on a holiday because they're boosting local economies. And there's this moral sort of feeling that you have to keep pumping it out for the whole economy to support us. And I wonder if we fear economic collapse more than irreversible climate change, or is there another way to look at it?
Well, I mean, I mean, I think certainly a lot of my research is just on the sort of nuts and bolts of energy efficiency. And in that, there have been quite a lot of research trying to look at, so if you had a massive investment program to make housing, or housing in the UK is very inefficient, to make housing really efficient, what would that do to jobs and growth? And what the studies normally show is actually, if you sort of transferred capital into making houses a lot more energy efficient, you would actually drive low carbon jobs. You create more jobs than you would destroy by spending the money on that rather than on something else. So to some extent, there's that argument that if you're moving to a low carbon economy, yes, OK, some jobs will go, but new jobs will be created. And, you know, there's a balance there. And certainly some research says that's quite positive, and it can be quite good, local, highly skilled jobs that are sort of meaningful work for people. So there's definitely some positives there. And I think, you know, the wider question about what does a low carbon economy look like? I mean, obviously, personal carbon trading or allowances is only a small part of that. And there are quite a lot of, you know, people doing serious work looking at this. There's in the UK, there's a guy called Tim Jackson who's just written the second version of his book called Prosperity Without Growth.
Yeah.
And that's there's another woman called Kate Raworth written something about donor economics, which is about sort of a just society living within climate, you know, global environmental limits. So sort of economists are trying to look at how do we restructure society. So I'm hopeful they'll come up with some clever answers.
Yes, me too. Well, I think the language we use is important, and I noticed in your articles you played around with that, that rations have connotations of austerity and even wartime, and allowances sound fairer and make you think of people pulling together, but personal carbon trading makes people think of rich people buying up poor people's allowances so they can go on with a climate-damaging lifestyle.
Yeah, I mean, the language is really quite interesting. And to be honest, we haven't done proper focus groups on it. What we've had is quite a lot of feedback from people. So the main work I've, or the first work I did on this was with a man called Meyer Hillman. And Meyer's in his 80s now and actually lived through the second, was a child in the Second World War. And so for him, when he started developing these ideas, he was using the language of rationing as something very positive, something that enabled everybody to get fed in the UK. It's based around food rationing, because the government decided if it didn't ration food, the unequal access meant, you know, some people would be starving. And so in his view, rationing was a very positive, socially just sort of word, whereas other people, audiences, when we talked about our work, people were going, oh, you can't call it rationing. And to them, rationing was all about austerity. It was about doing without. And so it's a word that has different meanings for different people. So we decided to switch to allowances because we thought that sounded a bit more neutral. And then the language of trading came around because trading is part of it, because of the starting point, because people have, in the same sort of income groups, have very, very different carbon allowances. We needed to introduce trading, and that became an umbrella term. And I'm personally a little bit uncomfortable with it in some respects, because as you say, it directs attention onto the trading aspect, whereas I think the important bit is the allowance aspect. It's that this is your share aspect that I feel is more resonant than the, oh, and by the way, if you need a bit more or you don't need all of it, you can buy and sell.
I think this is, we've got to start thinking about this, and that's why I think the personal carbon would get everybody thinking. You know, there's nothing like necessity being the mother of invention, and I really like the idea of a lot of people putting their thinking caps on about it as their daily aggravation about having just this allowance to work with would spur innovation or creativity, and I wondered if you've got some examples where it has.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I think we're all aware at the moment there's quite a lot of technological innovation around, particularly on renewable electricity, so solar PV. I know that's quite big in Australia, believe it or not, it's actually quite big in the UK as well. Well, we're very much upping our amount of electricity we get from wind power. So certainly on the supply side, there are sort of hopeful things happening. We'd also be thinking about things like social innovation. So, for example, bike share schemes and city bike schemes in Britain and, well, across Europe, those are, you know, really taking off, and giving people active modes of transport is, you know, is clearly good for people's health. It's good for all sorts of reasons, and it's also low carbon. I think, you know, as you said, if people were all operating within a budget, or they were trying to stay within their budget because they didn't want to face excess costs, and it became the social norm of, you know, you take pride in living within your budget, then you would be looking at, say, different forms of holiday. So maybe holidays nearer to home that were nevertheless exciting and interesting for people, and you'd expect providers to come up with those. You might expect more sort of car sharing type schemes. You might expect public transport to be a bit more attractive to people, and more investment to go into that because people would be looking for alternatives. And all sorts of, I don't know, perhaps new services. You've got some sort of carbon doctor that comes into your home and helps you sort of spot the obvious things where, without investing very much, you can improve, you know, you can reduce your carbon emissions. Like you said, I would expect, I mean, I, you know, I'm an academic, I'm not an entrepreneur, but you'd expect all sorts of people, if there's a new opportunity opening up, all sorts of people would come in and help us live within our carbon budget.
As an academic, I imagine you have plenty of people to talk to along the same lines, or like-minded people, but do you find in your life, just in your general life, that it's a rather lonely thing to be worried about climate change?
Well, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because I sit in a bit of a bubble. So I work somewhere called the Environmental Change Institute. So, of course, it's one of the biggest environmental changes that everybody's interested in. And in, I mean, just locally, our politics are fairly green in Oxford. So probably meet less sort of climate scepticism or less resistance than you would in other sort of local areas. That's just, you know, makes it a probably too comfortable a place to work. So quite privileged from that point of view. But nevertheless, it doesn't mean we're all doing the things that we really ought to do. And it doesn't mean we're taking the more radical steps that we ought to take. Because, you know, as we all know, nothing's happening happening fast enough, and we probably still haven't really grasped what it is we need to do and how fast we need to do it.
That's right. And the focus for climate activists in Australia is all on the big things, you know, phasing out coal-fired power stations, stopping new coal. We've got a big one here at the Galilee Basin with Adani. Stop Adani is a huge, you know, taking a huge amount of activism to stop that. And gas exports, we're meant to be the Saudi Arabia of gas in Australia. And we're trying to phase in wind and solar energy, but it's still only 17% of our total energy mix at the moment. And is coming out of many examples of that have been coming out of community initiatives. So there's a big appetite to do something, I think, at a personal level, because people are exasperated by government. They trusted in government. They didn't have much experience before, and they thought government would take care of this big new problem. But in fact, governments, it's just toxic for them. It's just political suicide to take on any big climate action. At least here it is. And so we have all these little things like bike paths and solar-powered roofs, but I think we need everyone to be thinking about it, be thinking about decarbonisation and what it involves. And the scale of the transition to clean energy is staggering. So I'd like to know, just to finish from you, how easy would it be to administer carbon restrictions? I know there was quite a big bureaucracy in the wartime to do the other sort of rationing, petrol and food rationing. It was quite a big bureaucracy to make sure it happened and make sure it was fair. But do you think it would be a big deal to implement this?
No, I think the actual implementation shouldn't be too difficult. I mean, cost is one way of understanding what a big deal it is. And I think even the government estimates, which people thought were a bit high, was the cost per year of running the system would be something like £30, which is €35. I don't know what that is in dollars, but I mean, it's not much, basically. It's not, you know, I mean, yes, it's a sum of money, but it's not a huge sum of money. And the setup costs would be similar. So, and, you know, and other people have said actually it could be half that cost. So I think that shows it's not necessarily a huge big deal, because it's really quite a simple thing, particularly for the direct uses of energy where we know what the carbon impact is. It's a very simple thing. That cost shouldn't be too much. And how you would sort of manage it would basically be through the big energy supply companies. You know, they would have to make sure the numbers added up, the people who are selling us the energy and the airlines and maybe the ferry companies when we know what they're up to. They're the ones who'd have to sort of prove to government that they hadn't sold more than the set of allowances that they'd got in from people. So, you know, there's some cost to them. And of course, we'd expect to see, as you mentioned earlier, sort of more information. So information on energy bills, information at petrol stations, information from airlines. But a lot of that's already happening. And certainly in the UK and across Europe, with smart meters coming in, there's a lot more sort of feedback and information is coming to customers about their home energy use and, in fact, business energy use as well. So there's all these opportunities for communicating with people that are already there that aren't a new cost. And the actual mechanics of managing the system, you know, compared with other things we do in society, are quite small. So I don't see that as the problem. I think, as you know, as we talked about earlier, it's just, you know, having the social agreement that this is a really important priority, and therefore we're going to put up with this minor inconvenience of having to pay in carbon, and we're going to have to put up with the learning to understand what it means to live within a carbon budget and how to manage that, because if we don't, the consequences for us are so much worse than putting up with that. And it's persuading people that it's a price worth paying. We have got to do something. This is a way of doing it fairly, transparently, and in a way that sort of engages everybody.
And I said at the beginning, would this go on forever? Because it seems to me it would only need to go on until we have decarbonised. Or is that naive?
No, well, I mean, that's what you'd hope, wouldn't it? That in, I mean, who knows, 30 years' time, we're kind of a largely zero carbon energy system, and therefore that's not necessary to have that sort of thing happening anymore.
Yes.
So, yes, you're right. If it's successful, it should fade out, because we fix the supply side as well as the demand side, and we don't need to do that anymore. Yeah.
And then hopefully that consciousness would attack the things where there's embodied carbon, like meat. And
that's right, with the idea being, because something's happening on the other side of the economy as well, that sort of relative prices or in some way will be changing. And so the sort of low carbon foods and goods and services should be seen cheaper to consumers. And, you know, if we're living in a society where we've recognised that carbon's a major constraint and we've all got to deal with it, it's not only about the prices, is it? It's also going to be about, you know, social norms. It's going to be about individual morals and ethical responsibility. all driving people to lower carbon choices and driving suppliers to come up with a lot more lower carbon choices.
Thank you very much, Tina. I think listeners will have lots of questions about that, and maybe, I hope, does get some impetus, some more stimulus. You said at the moment there's not a lot of oomph going into it at the moment, but I hope in the future it does come back on the table as a good plan to refine, and that the idea will take spark somewhere. Okay, so that was Dr. Tina Fawcett. She's the Acting Deputy Leader of the ECI Energy Program at Oxford University, which, as she said, is a bubble, but it sounds like a very pleasant bubble. And thank you for talking to us, Tina.
In this last show of the season, you just heard a sample from Vivian Langford from the Beyond Zero Emissions Show on 3CR Radio Australia. Vivian follows up with an interview with famous British author and journalist George Monbiot. Find a link to get the whole show at bze.org and in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. As many of you know, a few years ago I left Vancouver, Canada to find a more sustainable home and a healthy place to grow more of our own food. Many people have that dream. But what should we look for and what should we watch out for? From California, Diego Footer has a great podcast series called Permaculture Voices. I tuned in to episode number 226, titled Tips and Thoughts for Buying an Anti-Fragile Property, with Rob Avis, Part 2. Here is Diego with Rob Avis, co-founder of Verge Permaculture in Canada.
Welcome to Creative Destruction and the Voices of Change. I'm your host, Diego, D-I-E-G-O. We've all heard that phrase, be the change you want to see in the world. Today's episode is part two of the Anti-Fragile Property series with Rob Avis of Adaptive Habitat. If you missed part one, go back and check that one out. That was episode 222. You don't necessarily need to hear that one first, but it might put today's episode into better context. Because in that episode, episode 222, we looked at the idea of owning land as insurance. And today we're going to take that discussion of finding an anti-fragile property a step further and take a look at how you should approach purchasing a property if you're worried about things like climate change, the financial system crashing, debt, terrorism, disease, water insecurity, or a fragile food system, or all of them. Any, all, or none of those issues could hit you in a significant way during your lifetime. They might not, and they might. So if you're worried about them, how do you protect against them? One way is through property, specifically an anti-fragile property. What's anti-fragile? As Nassim Taleb defines it, it's simply something that gains from disorder. If we have a broken food system, your food forest becomes more valuable. If we have an energy crisis, an off-grid homestead, and a timber stand, keep your devices running. But that food forest, the technology, and the timber stand are all things that sit on the land. Today, we'll look at how to pick the right piece of land to make what you put on it more meaningful, or simply not even needed at all. Here it is, the Anti-Fragile Property Series with Rob Avis of Adaptive Habitat, Part 2.
So I'm back with Rob Avis, and last time on the episode, we talked about land as insurance. And I want to hit on some of the points that we touched on in last episode before we start to move on in this episode to how you can actually look for a property and what Rob thinks you should focus on when looking for a property. To start with here, I want to start talking about the idea of the anti-fragile property, you know, creating the ultimate enduring asset. When you think about the anti-fragile property in terms of like people who might be listening to the show, how do you think about that?
Yeah, I think the best way to start talking about this is to first just refresh people's mind about what anti-fragile actually is. And so if we think about fragility in three states, the word fragile, most people can wrap their head around what that means. The thing that comes to mind usually for most people is thinking about a package that you're shipping to a friend that might have wine glasses in it, and so the glasses are probably going to break. So fragile things break when you create volatility or disruption within the system. And so knowing that, the middle state, which is resilience, and a lot of people think of the word resilience in the ecological field, resilience actually means anti-fragile. But in this state, we're going to actually provide a little more granularity in these definitions. Resilient things resist breakage. So they are resilient against volatility or disruption. So concrete is a great example of that. You can hit it with a hammer. If you hit it enough times, the concrete will chip, but it's not going to break. And this is why we built buildings out of concrete. Anti-fragile things are things that actually improve with volatility. And the easiest way to think of this is your body. And so if you lift weight and you create little micro rips in your muscles, those little micro rips will heal back stronger than before you were lifting weight. And in fact, anti-fragile things have another characteristic, and you can think about it in the reverse, in that when you remove volatility from an anti-fragile element, it actually atrophies. And so our bodies, again, are a great example of this, in that if you stop working out, if you just sit on the couch for the rest of your life, your body's actually going to atrophy. So creating a metaphor over to the property side of things, properties that are anti-fragile, and I guess it depends on what it is that you're insuring against, because this concept of anti-fragility and property can kind of be looked at as a form of insurance as well. But let's say that we're concerned, like a lot of the clients that come to us are concerned about the future, and they are typically concerned about energy disruption or food disruption or water disruption. So the first thing you have to ask yourself is, what is it that you're trying to protect against? What kind of volatility are you trying to work against? And so if it's food, well, then you're looking for properties that can produce tons and tons of food. And so in a normal circumstance, when everything's fine around us globally, this property is going to continue to produce food. Where it benefits from volatility is that the food value coming off of that property in a volatile food situation, let's say the food system struggles or has some sort of a disruption, the food coming off of there will be worth far more. The property value will increase. We could look at that through water. We could look at that through the finance lens as well. Properties that insure against water disruption, energy disruption, food disruption, they're going to have considerably more value if any of those systems are disrupted through any number of, you know, events, essentially. So they're essentially properties that benefit from a certain dose-dependent amount of volatility, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm following you there. And I think that's what a lot of people are looking for. They want to prevent that shock in the system coming back to bite them. Water security, food security, I mean, they're becoming bigger things just with the drought I've seen here in California. You're starting to see even more, I'll call it average people, start to pay attention to water issues. So when you think about these types of properties themselves, what type of things do you think they need to have on them to create this anti-fragility in the property when it comes to a human-based system where humans are interacting and managing the property?
Really, it comes down to the fundamentals. And those fundamentals are, because we live on a planet that is predominantly or is operated through biological systems, we can go right down to the fundamentals of biology and what those needs are. Because realistically, I mean, we've all come to rely on electronics and all of the technology that runs on electricity, essentially, and some of them run on fossil fuels. And actually, a lot of our electricity comes from fossil fuels. But as we know, that we're in a very rapid transition from fossil fuels to renewables right now. But fundamentally, like if a severe disruption occurred in any number of those areas that we discussed, I would much rather be saddled with a really biodiverse, healthy, thriving ecosystem fundamentally operating on biology as an insurance package than be relying on a whole bunch of technology. Now, I'm not saying these properties shouldn't have technology like solar panels and batteries and all the other stuff that that we're embracing right now. But when it comes down to what a property should have, I think one of the most valuable things that a property can have, and one of the things that I look through, the lens that I look through most often, is water. We can do a lot to enhance water cycles. We can capture what's coming onto the property. We have a really neat opportunity up here in the northern hemisphere where we get snow. I mean, you think about this. When I see a snowstorm outside, a lot of people just look at that as snowflakes falling from the ground. But there's actually millions of gallons of water falling from the sky. And if you look at a property through its interaction with wind, snow, rain. Wherever you live, if you live in a place where you get snow seasonally, we can look at the property through that lens of how can we capture more snow on the property. We can literally create water harvesting elements in these northern climes just by putting up snow fences and completely shift the whole water dynamic of a property. But if you buy a property without water, it creates all sorts of interesting constraints that are really tough to come back from. Solar access is another one. A lot of people that come out of these ecological design courses, permaculture design courses, all talk about, especially in my climate, getting south-facing slopes because they've got this really great hot microclimate. And I'm not dogmatic about the microclimate that you end up with. It's all about, you know, working with it, essentially. And in my climate, we're pretty dry up here. Maybe not quite as dry as California, but, you know, we get anywhere from 10 to 15 inches of rain in metric. That's, 300 to 330 millimeters of water, which isn't a lot. And so I actually really like the northern aspects for microclimate as well, because those are generally are a lot more moist. And so we can do all sorts of interesting things that we can't do on a southern aspect. So I like to get a variation of microclimates on a property as well. That's going to give us a lot of opportunity. I like to know what kind of nutrient, like all biology needs nutrient. And so it's good to know kind of where the soils are at, both microbially and from a nutrient perspective. And then it's good to have a good sense of the proximity to markets as well. I mean, not everybody wants to start a business on these properties, but I like to look at the kind of regulatory and market opportunities that exist around these properties, because it creates optionality, essentially.
But one thing you stressed last episode, and you've talked about before, is people tend to buy the wrong piece of land driven by sentiment. So they might know that they want these characteristics, but is it their vision of how these characteristics are starting on the landscape or how they implement these characteristics on the landscape that sometimes lead them down the wrong paths? Meaning, I think in one of the examples you had, and this might have been in a blog post, somebody had a lot of water and they wanted to drain the water to create a farm where it was like preserve the wetland and just create a food system within the wetland itself.
Totally. I see more properties purchased that are incorrect than anything else. And I think it really comes down to a couple of things. Number one, we're really good at going to the grocery store and buying $5, $10, $100 things. Like, we do that on a semi-regular basis, and we're good at doing comparative shopping, looking at the benefits, looking at the reviews, trying to understand the pros and cons of buying one thing or another. And if we get it wrong, it's not the end of the world. We can buy the one that we thought we didn't want that actually was better than the one that we ended up buying. And it's not really going to cost us a lot. But when it comes to buying houses, most, or even properties for that matter, most of us might buy one, two, three, maybe if you're really wealthy, five or six in your lifetime. And so we don't have the same amount of repetition, basically, when it comes to buying property. And so we tend to look at the lipstick. And by lipstick, I mean things like view, how nice the kitchen is inside, you know, does it have a clawfoot bathtub? All these types of things seem to take precedent. And what's interesting is that the humans adapt really quickly. And so that view that you thought you wanted, you probably won't notice it after 2 or 3 years. And maybe you will. Some people do. That kitchen's going to wear down over time. These things that you think are important aren't really important. So I would say sentiment is one of our biggest limitations to culture, or cultural sentiment is one of our biggest limitations to yield. Yield being kind of propelling us towards our goals, essentially. It's kind of funny because sometimes I actually think I'm more of a marriage counselor than I am a land consultant, because inevitably one part of the couple wants one thing, one part wants the other. And so they end up kind of arguing about what's important and what's not important. I actually wrote a blog once, I think it was a couple of years ago, and it was something like avoiding the tears and buying the right piece of property. Because I kept getting so many couples that I don't go into these things trying to make people cry, but inevitably they end up crying, because when you're dealing with $500,000 or $1 million and you realize that you've got the wrong property and it doesn't propel you towards that vision or that place that you want to be in, it's a really expensive mistake.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We are listening in to a discussion with permaculture podcaster Diego and his guest, Rob Avis, co-founder of The Verge Permaculture in Canada.
You're right. I mean, those are essentially features. You know, in marketing, there's that saying, features tell, benefits sell. And a lot of times features are what people go after when they buy things. This 5-acre property near me came up from sale. And now hearing you think about this or talk about this, I'm trying to like step back and say, okay, don't just be attracted to the number, the size of the property. There's obviously a lot of other things that come into that. But I fully get literally right now how easy it can be to see something and then start progressing the dream, you know, right now in your head of what it could be, what you might want it to be. And that doesn't always align up with various things, your holistic context, what the land can actually give you, what's best for the land, where do you want to go, you know, if this is business related. So there's a lot of factors here. And I fully get like this problem of sentiment. And I think this is a problem you see people make on even small purchases up to land itself.
It's really important for people to think about what a high level goal is. It's not granite countertops and, you know, a view of the ocean sort of thing. Those are not high level goals. Those examples would be detailed goals. So things that you can see when you're really close to it. High level goals are kind of goals that you'd see at 30,000 feet. They're visions, they're characteristics that can be achieved in many different ways. So what's really great about spending time setting goals on the front end is that we can test different opportunities against those vision statements using the framework, using the holistic context framework to understand whether or not it actually provides the largest thrust towards those visions. What it is that we do is we take those goal statements and we translate it into qualifiable and quantifiable metrics that our clients can use to go and test various options against. And that's the piece that when somebody hires a real estate agent to look at land, there's a couple of things going on there. There's a huge conflict of interest. First of all, the real estate agent is supposed to be there representing, you know, your behalf. And some of them do this for sure. They're not all, I mean, the system's set up with an inherent conflict of interest, but there are some really good real estate agents out there. But ultimately, they're being driven by the commission at the back end. When you can get somebody involved that actually will start right from those high level goal statements that can represent you and that they've already been paid to render a service, it doesn't really matter to that person which one you end up getting. The thing that matters to that person is making sure that his customer is happy on the back end for the service that they've been hired for. And just to hit on the context a little bit more, I think that the other thing that's really important after you have those goal statements, I think the other thing to really think about, the question that always, I use this in my business, I use this with my clients, I use it in all aspects of my life, is what's the weakest link? What is the thing that you're trying to achieve by, in this case, buying a piece of property? And is that property, that 5-acre property that you're looking at, is that going to address your weakest link? Or is there another way that you can deploy the capital or the time or any of the resources that you're looking to deploy to give you a greater thrust towards that end vision? And so that would be one of the first questions that I would ask after I had sat down and created these high-level goals with people is, what's going to give you the greatest thrust? And is this going to actually address the weakest link?
I think many times the bite of our mind is much greater than the ability of our body to physically act out on some of this land. So many of us have these grand land aspirations, but I don't think everyone has the time to do everything that they'd ever want to do on that land in a way that matches the quality that they have in their mind's eye, or they don't have the capital or the amount of labor to actually get these visions into reality. So I think going back to the sentiment, I think people fall in love with these ideas without checking it back against the reality of, can I realistically ever make this idea happen in the real world, given all the other things happening in my life, job, kids, whatever. And I think that's where I think a lot of people get hung up, even me now thinking like this 5-acre thing. I mean, that's always my check is like, I'm having trouble maybe managing less than an acre. You know, if I go 5 acres, I won't be able to maximize that nearly as much as I am now. And then that means I'm totally changing around the management system I have on the property. And then that goes back into context of like, does this more spread out wide scale management style across more acreage, is that really what I want to do? And does that line up with where we want to go?
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me a little of the episode that we did on raising kids. And one of the listeners wrote back and said, I'm working so hard to, you know, to build out this farm for my kids, and yet I'm not spending any time with my kids. And so for you and me, our context is very family-centric, and that represents a really big part of our high-level vision, is having that freedom of time and space to be with our kids. You know, for other people, that those high-level visions are going to be different. You know, Newton said it best, whenever you every action has an equal and opposite reaction, and trying to understand how these decisions are going to interplay into that reality, basically, and which, by making this action, what other moving parts in the system are going to get affected, and trying to be a little bit more conscientious about that is really what all this stuff comes down to. And so that's the goal side of things. Once you've kind of figured out what those goals are, then we can start to get into some of the mechanics of and like translating some of these high level goals into reality.
What do you think about this? You know, a lot of people come into this space and they want to find a property to then live out this vision on. They might want to make the anti-fragility on the property. And to do that, they're essentially going to permaculture the shit out of the property. They want to follow in the footsteps of what you do, what Ben Falk does, Sepp Holzer, Darren Doherty, Jeff Lawton, etc. And there's a way you could design anti-fragility into these properties anywhere in the world. But for somebody who is business-centric, family-centric, and they're looking for this anti-fragility, do you think you can buy a property that has natural conditions of anti-fragility in it that you as a human can exploit? Meaning, if you select the right property, you don't really do anything to it. There's not any management. There's not any hardcore earth scarring coming in, because the systems are in place, be that water systems or a forest system. And by you just purchasing the property smartly, you've built your fragility, anti-fragility in that way. And then you don't have to take time away from the other things in life you may want to or may have to care about. Because I see that's one route. The other route is you buy a property and you essentially, you work with nature or whatever, but you kind of beat it into submission.
No, totally, man. I mean, we've looked at properties. There's this incredible, this romantic idea of raising livestock. A lot of us have it. A lot of us want to control livestock or manage or work with them. But I've often said, like, why not hunt? There's actually a diminishing number of hunters in North America right now. Hunting is a really crucial part of ecosystem management. And in a week of time in the fall, like, I can go out and harvest enough meat for the entire winter. Maybe I find a local pig farmer and I buy some of his lard or a little bit of pork here or there. But, you know, just siting your house or finding the right piece of property that has access to wild productivity, and then training yourself in some skills that I get this all the time. People will buy these properties in forests and they'll be like, oh, we got to cut the forest down so that we can grow pigs and chickens and cows. And like, why? You've got deer, moose, and elk right outside your door. Get a gun and learn how to hunt. Buying a property that has water rights. I think water is going to be the master resource in the future. And having a piece of paper that says that you've got rights to water coming off of a glacier is an incredible asset. Number one, you'll be able to drink, which is really important. But, you know, down the road, there might be other opportunities that water provides that you can't anticipate right now. We can't do anything without water on this planet. Having access to timber and biomass, like living near or inside of a forest, as long as you've taken into account any of the risk factors that may be associated with living in that forest. You know, one of the things that concerns me all the time up here, being a mechanical engineer, is the fact that it gets down to minus 30 degrees Celsius, which is pretty close to minus 30 Fahrenheit. And, you know, in the prairies, we live largely without trees. And so, and our houses are built in a similar fashion to the way they'd be built in California. So a minus 30 situation in the middle of winter with a failure in the electricity and or the gas grid means no heat. And most of these houses aren't built with wood stoves. And if even if they are built with wood stoves, there's no wood to burn because we live on the prairie. And so for every ecosystem, there's a way to build. There's resources that you can acquire or that you can manage that don't require you to have to pummel the ecosystem into submission just so that you can meet your specific romantic goal of raising livestock or growing avocados or whatever your vision is. There's lots of different ways of meeting those goals. And it really comes right back down to the goals. Like, what is it that you're trying to create insurance around? Because that's really what we're talking about here, is just finding alternative strategies to ensure risks that you're concerned about or that you've identified as being things that are fragilizing you.
Yeah, it's got me thinking of something you mentioned in a previous podcast of where you now disclose to clients, like, my recommendation may be to do nothing. And in a lot of cases, I feel like there's so many ideas, and I'm guilty of propagating a lot of these ideas out there in this space. A lot of that sounds interesting. A lot of that sounds fun to do. It's unique. It's fun to dream about. But in many cases, hearing you talk, it's like the best option may be to just do nothing, to buy the system that is already running itself, that you don't have to do anything in except come in, you know, establish a house, get your basic systems up, and then just manage as you need to based upon your needs. It's a very high level, almost like Zen level of thinking in this space, because it kind of renders a lot of the techniques that we've learned. There's a bit of saying, well, I'm never going to need that, or I'm not going to have to use that. You know, nature's done this for me. So maybe you can observe maybe use all the stuff you've learned to observe these features in nature to come upon the place, but not having to do them, I think, is wise. And it also takes a massive amount of restraint, because I think the natural instinct is to come in to a system that might solve all your needs in and of itself by itself, and then come in and start doing stuff just to do it.
One of the things that any individual can do, whether they have money or not, and they'll end up benefiting themselves in so many other ways, you know, without even owning land, is just teach yourself how to fast. You know, that's a perfect example of right now I eat about a meal a day is what I'm averaging. Sometimes I eat more than that. I'm not wasting away. In fact, I'm getting stronger. My body is actually getting stronger by limiting the caloric intake. I've solved a couple of medical issues. So at the lowest level of value, my health's improved. I'm actually spending less money on food than I was. I feel better. I have more energy. My brain works better. And on the highest level of value, you know, if a food disruption ever did happen, I've actually started to train my body and my brain to fundamentally function on fewer calories daily. And so how can you buttress your life with things? By having the right piece of property, buying it in the right piece of land, investing in the right infrastructure, making sure the right characteristics are there. There's all sorts of mental things that you can do to harden yourself. I mean, we as North Americans live in climate-controlled conditions, 21 degrees Celsius all the time, summer or winter. You know, we expect 3 meals a day. You know, we have all these things. And a lot of times what's really interesting when you go down this path of trying to create resilience for people is that trying to replace a North American lifestyle, so the 30 kilowatt hours of power that we consume a day, the 375 gallons, sorry, I should use it in talk in Imperial as well, 75 to 100 gallons of water, or 300 to 400 liters of water a day, you know, flush toilets, lights whenever we want them. Trying to replace that level of supply, I guess, is super expensive. And so you inevitably, the resilient or the insurance policy on the back end inevitably has to be much smaller, which if people are thinking ahead, they should be kind of coming to the conclusion that they should be teaching themselves to live with less right now. It goes right back into what the Romans were talking about in their concept of stoicism.
So thinking about this, before we jump into the idea of what to look for in terms of buying land, you know, a checklist, if you will, do you think the approach is to first say, how do we buy the right piece of land for the North American that wants plug-in technology, 21 degrees C temperatures all the time, showers that just turn on? Or do you think that the approach to buying land starts with you restricting things in your life or paring back what your expectations are to start? I see those as two separate approaches that might not lead you to the same property.
Yeah, they're totally different. It's really going to come down to dollars and cents at the end of the day. I mean, we've definitely worked with clients that don't have a budget. And so their systems can be set up in a way that there'll be a seamless, most likely a seamless transition from the system that we have right now to, you know, whatever system may happen in the future if a disruption would occur. And then there's clients that do have budgets. You know, those systems look a lot different. Those properties may look different as well. Sometimes the property can be the same. Sometimes people will have goals of living within a certain bioregion. And so you kind of have to work within that bioregion. Because there's so many variables, there's really an unlimited number of possibilities on the back end, which is why I think people struggle so much to buy the right piece of land. And so the good news is that because there's so many ways to iterate, you know, you can usually work through a situation. The thing that we're trying to do more than buying the right piece of land, because there's so many ways to do that, is to make sure that we don't buy land with type one errors, like things that you can never come back from. That's the most important thing. So instead of trying to solve the affirmative, we make sure that we avoid the negative, if that makes sense.
It does. And just for people listening, can you elaborate on what type one errors might be?
Yeah. I mean, buying a house in a floodplain, that's one that I see so often. And this comes back down to black swans and statistics. People will say, well, you know, this hasn't flooded for 500 years, or I'm on a 1 in 500 year floodplain. A lot of people that don't understand stats might think, well, that means that I'm only going to live for another 60 years, and therefore a 1 in 500 year flood is never going to happen. That's not how statistics works. We could have a 1 in 500 year flood 5 years in a row, and it could still be a 1 in 500 year flood. So understanding kind of the watershed and where your infrastructure lies within that watershed, that'd be a type 1 error. Buying a house in a forest where all the trees around you require, or the tree seeds, I should say, require fire to germinate those seeds. So you're in a fire ecology, and then not having the ability to protect your infrastructure because you don't have enough water resources. Buying a house that has a sump pump that runs every 5 minutes. I mean, making a house like that have the ability to be off grid is almost impossible, because all your money, you're going to basically spend $5,000 to $10,000 on a solar system just to run a sump pump. And so, like, I can go through like item after item after item. There's lots of things that, like, people set up properties incorrectly, or they place elements in the wrong place, or you know, I had a client in Ontario talk to me about a property that has a really steep road, and I was like, and she said every year this thing washes out. Well, if society just continues to go on as it will, which I think it will, you know, I'm not a doomsday or anything like that. I just think about things through that lens of insurance. But at the very lowest level of situational occurrences, that driveway is going to have to be repaired every year, and it's like $1,500 minimum. Not to mention you have to have special tires to get up it. You've got like all these other things that go along with having a road that needs lots of maintenance. And then in the event that there is a disruption, how are you going to get up that road? There's like little booby traps everywhere you go on properties. And, you know, your house inspector will look for a certain number of them. But there's all sorts of other things that they will never look at because they're not coming at it from that insurance or anti-fragile perspective.
We're running out of time here on Radio EcoShock for this hour. Let's let Diego wrap up his show, and then I'll pass on how to hear the rest of this interesting discussion on finding the right place to ride it out.
To read some of Rob's writings, visit vergepermaculture.ca. And finally, if you're overwhelmed by all of this and you don't know where to start and maybe thinking, I just want Rob to do that, he can. To learn more about Rob's design work and his design firm and some of the services they offer, visit adaptivehabitat.ca. To download some of the highlights from this episode, visit permaculturevoices.com/podcast and click on episode number 226. So get to work, find something that you love and fulfills you, and go for it. The journey will be hard, you'll want to quit, it'll take everything out of you, and odds are that you'll fail. I hope that you do it anyway.
That was Diego, host of the Permaculture Voices podcast. I highly recommend it. Tune in at permaculturevoices.com. Of course, I'll put loads of links in my own show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. In September, I'll be back with another year of all-new Radio EcoShock shows. Starting next week, I'll be pulling some of the really big interviews from past Radio EcoShock programs going back as much as 12 years as our summer programming begins. These scientists, authors, and activists stand the test of time, and they are worth your time, so please keep tuning in. As always, thank you for listening and caring about our world.
We're joined now by Mark Taliano, I believe. Are you there, Mark?
Yes, I am. How are you, Phil?
Good, and we're glad to be talking to you. You're a research associate of the Center for Research and Globalization, and you've, of course, you've written a book, Voices from Syria. I should tell people, Mark has a Twitter site, and I was just checking it out today. It's terrific. It's M.A. Taliano. And I urge everybody to go to it. Of course, you just write his name in and you come up.
Global Research. My articles are up there, too.
And your articles are at Global Research. Yep. Mark, you've had an accidental adventure. You were visiting Syria when all this missile business and the chemical weapons charges was going on. Is that right?
Yes, I was. The first night there, I had the unfortunate experience of being awakened by missiles and bombs, cruise missiles, fired from the French, British, and U.S.
That must have been sobering.
It was very frightening.
Mm-hmm.
Very upsetting.
Did you...
loud.
Yeah. And you were where? Damascus?
I was in Damascus, and apparently some may have hit 5 kilometers of me. It was very, very loud, very unpleasant.
Mm-hmm.
Underscores what Syrians have been living with for 7 years.
Yes. You've made many visits, and of course, you've probably heard attacks before, but that one seemed to be one that they wanted to put an exclamation point on or something. I mean, in terms of, you know, they used to use that word shock and awe.
Shock and awe. Well,
they registered that, at least in terms of noise, reminding everybody that they're still hovering around.
Yeah, in terms of noise, it was awful. Not in terms of damage, not so much. So the Syrians that I spoke to viewed it as a victory for Syria. Apparently, 71 missiles or bombs or whatever you want to call them were shot down, mm-hmm. 103 that were launched. But the shock and awe has been occurring for 7 years with the mortars that have been falling on innocent people.
Mm-hmm.
That's the shocking and eyeing part. They kill kids and mm-hmm. chop off their legs, and they've been doing that for 7 years. So now that the terrorists are almost cleaned out from the area of Damascus, people are uh-huh. breathing a sigh of relief, and they're more willing to go outside of their homes. At 11:30, I was talking to Pierre Lacorf, who is a French citizen. He's a saint, really. He's been in, I did an interview with him. He's on my one of my most recent articles. And he works with young people. Like most people are traumatized by this war.
Mm-hmm.
He says that whereas before when the mortars were falling from the terrorists outside of Damascus, the terrorists that were bombing haphazardly Damascus citizens, whereas before the kids felt... them to die. They had accepted death. They had lost loved ones. They'd seen their friends crippled and killed. They'd were ready for it. And imagine, and this is not easy for us to imagine because these are just kids, 12 years old to 17 years old. But that's the trauma they had to live with.
Yes.
And now, Pierre says they are condemned to live.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they don't see hope. They have these invisible scars.
Mm-hmm.
They see all this bombing,
mm-hmm.
and it's extraordinarily traumatic, something that we can't imagine.
This is Mark Taliano, and he is the author of Voices from Syria. There's also a Twitter account. And I urge you to go to it. And by the way, that your interview with Pierre Lacarpe is posted there. People should listen to that.
He's a saint. He's a hero.
Yeah. So what did you see? What was the experience like the rest of your days here? You had a rather quick trip. I mean, you were in and out and got a taste of what it's like to be on the ground and for the Syrians.
Yeah, well, it's my second time there. What I've said, and I experienced this again, and it brings tears to my eyes sometimes. Of all the places I've been in the world, the Syrians are the most welcoming I ever met, the most welcoming, friendly people, and my government is trying to destroy their country. So I'm still trying to figure this out, how they can be so nice and welcoming, and I'm not the only one who feels this way. Other people visiting, they all feel extraordinarily welcome by these people who are being victimized by our governments.
One thought occurs to me, and that is that they are a civilization,
yes,
as opposed to some of the what Donald Trump represents.
I think you hit it right there. They are a civilization. We were in the world's literally the world's oldest church is where Saint Paul was baptized, and it's 15 feet underground because it's so old. Mm-hmm. They build on top of ruins and
yes,
ancient civilizations. This is where Christianity was born and civilizations were born. And we are trying to destroy it. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by destroying it is what is happening in these terrorist-controlled areas, which are now being liberated, we see what happens. Children are not allowed to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And the women are repressed, extraordinarily so. They're extraordinarily misogynist terrorists we support. Mm-hmm. And it ties in with previous conquerors. The person who was taking us on tour said that during the Ottoman reign, that's where the full covering for women, full facial covering, et cetera, for women originated with the niqab. It's not indigenous to Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And in that time, too, people were not allowed to go to school. Just like in terrorist areas, Syria, children are not allowed to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
You can guess why.
Yeah.
Because if they're not educated, they can be used as soldiers and they can be manipulated. They can be in one group after another, all to destroy a country which previously had free health care, free education, including higher education, extraordinary mosaic of people, tolerant.
Mm-hmm.
They embrace Christianity. They embrace all religions. If you ask a Syrian today, what religion are you? That is a rude question because they are first and foremost Syrians.
Mm-hmm.
These are signs that, like you said, it is a civilization, a very rich civilization. We are trying to destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really heartbreaking, especially when you meet these people, because they're so warm and welcoming. And I put myself in their shoes and I think, okay, so let me figure this out. If people were invading my country or paying terrorists and supporting terrorists and controlling terrorists to invade my country, and if visitors from that invading country came to my...
Yes.
Would I...
Mm-hmm.
I welcome them. Well,
That's it.
It would be easy to hate them, let's just put it this way.
Yes.
But I have yet to experience that, not once. Yeah. I experienced that in Syria in my two times being there during the war.
Well, by the way, that's another thing that we should remind everybody. It's a very sophisticated political culture. They have been under, as you say, there was the Ottomans and the French.
Yeah.
And they were treated harshly in both cases, and now the French and the Americans and others. So they understand in a far more advanced way than this culture would. Who they're dealing with.
I think that's what it is. Yeah. When I was there, they had a national holiday celebrating the liberation from the French occupation. Mm-hmm.
That's right. It is the anniversary.
Yeah, they have a better understanding of what is going on by far, which brings me to the next point.
Yeah, and by the way, why don't everybody remind the world and Trump and Macron and all that Syria was a founding member of the United Nations.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a member of the United Nations, and every day we're committing war crimes against it.
Yes. It's Mark Taliano, and he's got a book of voices from Syria. And, of course, I mentioned a Twitter account. I do urge you to go to that. Mark, I share with you this anger and at Canada's just going along.
Yes.
I mean, by the way, in the most cowardly way, they just stand by while three superpowers fire missiles into Syria, which is an act of war by anybody's definition.
Oh,
and the Canadian government says, well, we're not going to go, but we approve of it. Actually, I mean, they were doing another thing which is quite vicious, which is the support of sanctions and the closing of diplomatic ties and embassies.
Yes,
now, these are things we could correct. I mean, Canadians should be calling out.
Yes, the sanctions are vicious. They're illegal. They're unilateral. And they are killing, as all sanctions do, many, many, many innocent Syrian people. We were talking to Elizabeth Moss from the World Health Organization. Since the war started, about 5 million people have died avoidable deaths. Mm-hmm. They cannot. This is a country that had its own pharmaceutical industry. It previously, which were targeted by us, by our countries and our terrorists, the terrorists that we support. Mm-hmm. It previously had 90%. It made 90% of its own pharmaceuticals. I went into a pharmacy shop and I couldn't recognize one single medication because they're all Syrian made.
Mm-hmm.
No brand names hardly at all.
Mm-hmm.
And now they have a shortage of cancer drugs.
Yes.
Now. They have a shortage. They have a shortage of artificial limbs, mm-hmm. and there's about 1.5 million Syrians who have severe physical trauma, including loss of limbs, and so they can't even get them artificial limbs, thanks in large part to the sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
They can't get the cancer medications. 1 in 20 Syrians suffers severe psychological trauma. I understand that totally.
Mm-hmm.
Not knowing when you're going to lose a leg, not knowing when a mortar is going to kill you or your friend.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very filthy, dirty criminal game that imperialists have played for a long, long time. And I'm seeing how such a filthy, dirty game, criminal war game it is. Yeah. I mean,
it's that aspect of the – it's like the Albright formula. It's worth it. We starve them and they – you know, the children die, but it's worth it. And in the case of Canada, they put sanctions and just whistle while nobody looks at them and said, what did you just do?
Yeah, exactly. We are not complicit. We are accomplices.
Mm-hmm.
And we provide political support, overflights, refueling, illegal sanctions, and much more, everything in coordination with NATO – and their allies. We deal weapons with Saudi Arabia. This whole war would not have had. Oh, the only reason it's happening is because of the West. It's a covert operation. It's a regime change war. Our defense minister said it publicly. It is a regime change war. That in itself is a war crime. He's announcing in neon that, okay, we're committing war crimes here, which is what they're doing.
Yes,
but when I see these kids, you know, going to school and mm-hmm. and happy and walking and with their teachers, it's a beautiful thing. But then you think, my God,
mm-hmm.
we are targeting these kids.
What they've been through,
it's horrible.
Yeah.
And now, nobody deserves it.
And lastly, Mark, there is. It looks. We were just speaking to Steve Sahuni previous. There is some. The Syrian Arab Army has rallied with the support of Russia and Islamic Republic and others. But it really, this army is showing itself now as the people's army, and it is succeeding. Is that palpable? Can you tell in a change in mood in the Syrian people?
The Syrian people love the army.
Mm-hmm.
The Syrian people are the army.
Mm-hmm.
Conscript army. They are the brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles. They are the army. There's women and men in it. We at the gate to the where we were staying, ancient gate. There's two young ladies. One was a tank driver. One was, I think, a sniper. They are the army. When they're very. This is another shocking thing. The way they treat even the army. The way they treat us. They're always smiling and they're
mm-hmm.
friendly. They don't want to have their pictures taken for the most part, which is totally understandable at checkpoints, of course, not for security reasons. Yeah. But the Army are the people. Yeah. People are the Army. They're one and the same.
Well, I like that formula.
This is an Army that's had plenty of hands-on experience with fighting terrorists now.
Yeah.
Okay? And they don't, with this Army, they go in house to house. That's not an easy job. They don't rely on carpet bombing, which bothers multitudes, because these are their people.
Yeah. Well, Mark Taliano, we're going to have to leave it there, but it's been very informative, and thank you for making that trip, and thank you for your writing, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks, Phil.
Okie doke.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is Taylor Report.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Shireen Aladami, Assistant Professor of Education at Michigan State University, who discusses the current Saudi-led attack on Yemen's port city of Hodeidah in a nation gripped by famine and disease. Timothy Carr, the media democracy group Free Press, who takes a critical look at what the AT&T-Time Warner merger will mean for consumers and citizens. And Carol Bubar-Blodgett, also known as Spirit Hawk, who talks about her 8th annual Water is Life walk, where she hiked the length of the Housatonic River from western Massachusetts to the river's mouth on the Connecticut coast of Long Island Sound. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Three years ago, Chinese authorities in the western province of Xinjiang, with a large Muslim population known as Uyghurs, ordered everyone in the provincial capital, Urumqi, to return to the towns in which they were born to get a new identity card. This order imposed hardships on families who had migrated to the capital city to find work. Uyghur militancy has taken a violent turn in recent years. In 2013, a Uyghur driver crashed a car into pedestrians in Tiananmen Square. In 2014, a knife-wielding Uyghur gang slaughtered 31 travelers at a train station in the city of Kunming in Yunnan Province. Chinese and Syrian officials say 1,500 Uyghurs have fought in Syria with the Islamic State or the Al-Qaeda-affiliated group Jabhat Nusra. Today, there are 73 re-education camps for Uyghurs in Xinjiang, according to German researcher Adrian Zenz. In the largest Uyghur city, Kashgar, 120,000 people are held in re-education camps. The Chinese government argues that harsh measures are needed to prevent violence associated with Uyghur separatism and conflict with ethnic Han Chinese. Also, Xinjiang is now China's largest producer of domestic oil and gas, and much of the fossil fuels imported from Central Asia and Russia are transported through this region. The conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court upheld Ohio's aggressive voter purge law, which allows voters to be scrubbed from the registration rolls if they miss two consecutive federal elections. Only a handful of states have such punitive voting regulations, which disproportionately impact poor people and communities of color. The case was brought by plaintiff Larry Harmon, a software engineer who couldn't vote during the 2015 ballot initiative on legalizing marijuana. In accordance with Ohio law, his name was removed from the rolls because he hadn't voted in two consecutive elections, nor had he sent back a postcard the state had sent him to confirm that his address had not changed. A federal court of appeals in Cincinnati ruled in favor of Harmon, saying the Ohio purge law violated the National Voter Registration Act, commonly known as the Motor Voter Law. But in a 5-4 ruling on June 11th, the conservative majority on the Supreme Court declared Ohio's purge law was constitutional since the state had mailed notices to confirm voter registration addresses. Justice Samuel Alito, in the majority opinion, claimed there were 24 million voter registrations that were invalid or inaccurate. However, in a stinging dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor, cited the heavy impact of the law on African Americans. In Cincinnati, 10% of black voters were taken off voter rolls, in contrast to only 4% of voters in the city's white-majority suburbs. The National Fair Housing Alliance recently issued its annual Fair Housing Trends Report. The study found that the number of housing discrimination complaints continues to rise as the Trump administration is rescinding rules that impose strict deadlines on states and localities to address housing discrimination and segregation. In response, the National Fair Housing Alliance and other fair housing advocates have gone to federal court to force the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, to reinstate the federal requirement that local and state governments work to eliminate housing discrimination patterns as a condition of receiving HUD funding. In 2017, 57% of fair housing complaints involved people with disabilities. The second largest category of complaints stemmed from racial bias. The biggest obstacle to a person or family's right to housing, as it turns out, is still the federal government's failure to vigorously enforce existing laws. According to the American Prospect, the Trump Treasury Department recommended repealing fair housing enforcement under the Dodd-Frank banking reform law in the auto lending sector. Meanwhile, Treasury officials also recommended that HUD pull back from decades-long precedent by not applying key provisions of the Fair Housing Act to the insurance industry. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Yemen's vital port city of Hodeidah is under attack by a Saudi Arabia-led military coalition, employing both airstrikes and ground troops from the United Arab Emirates. International aid groups say that the offensive launched last week to drive out Houthi rebels is disrupting the delivery of critical food and medical supplies in a nation already gripped by famine and a cholera epidemic. According to the United Nations, an estimated 10,000 people, two-thirds of them civilians, have been killed and 55,000 others injured in Yemen's three-year civil war. The conflict in Yemen between Shia Houthi rebels and forces loyal to Yemen's president, Abdul Rabu Mansour Hadi, began in 2014 after rebels seized control of the capital city of Sana'a. Saudi Arabia and allied Gulf nations launched a brutal bombing campaign targeting the Houthis in March 2015. Human rights groups have condemned the nonstop U.S.-supported Saudi airstrikes for repeatedly targeting civilians and civil infrastructure such as schools, hospitals, and markets. Your reporter spoke with Shireen Al-Adami, assistant professor of education at Michigan State University, who's originally from Yemen. Here she discusses the current attack on the port city of Hodeidah, famine, a cholera epidemic, and the role of the U.S. military.
Yemen right now, Scott, is experiencing what the UN calls the worst humanitarian crisis on earth. If your listeners remember, at the height of the cholera epidemic in Haiti, there were about 750,000 people who were infected by cholera. In Yemen, the number has already surpassed a million people. And, you know, cholera is due to lack of access to clean water. There's essentially, you know, it's very difficult to access clean water in Yemen. Yemen used to even import its water as well as 90% of its food. So people are having trouble accessing water. They're getting sick. And then the remedy for cholera is as simple as, you know, rehydrating with clean water and electrolytes and so on. But again, the health system has been so destroyed that people don't often have access. And a lot of the children who've died because of cholera are you know, their immune systems are weakened because of hunger and malnutrition. So we're talking 113,000 children who've died due to diseases like cholera and starvation in the years 2016 and 2017 alone. 113,000 children. This is the impact of this war. This is in addition, of course, to the over 44,000 deaths from violent deaths. And this is the newest figure that's been updated from the 10,000 that we've often heard. the country is essentially completely in ruins. The healthcare system has been destroyed. The education system is barely functioning. Civil society has been destroyed. So it's had a very devastating impact. And this is what happens when you have a coalition of countries and an international community that is attacking the Middle East's poorest country.
Shireen, as many of us have been reading, the Saudi-led military coalition is currently launching an assault on the vital Yemeni port of Hodeidah on the Red Sea. As I understand it, this port is the most critical point where food and humanitarian aid enter the country, the little humanitarian aid that does find its way to Yemen. Tell us about this attack and the concern the world has about the consequences for Yemen's civilian population.
So in the past, the Americans, even though they've been very helpful to the Saudis in this war, have drawn a red line when it comes to Hodeidah, because they recognize that if Hodeidah port is attacked, you know, this is where 70% of aid comes into the country, and 80% of the population is reliant on the food and the aid that's coming in through the port of Hodeidah, that if it was attacked and the shipments are disrupted in any way, then these 22 million people will essentially starve to death. And so, you know, last week, the UAE decided to lead this offensive on Hodeidah, and they've ignored all sorts of calls by U.S. senators and, you know, U.S. generals. And unfortunately, as soon as they began attacking on Wednesday, the U.S. jumped to help them by providing airstrike targeting. So again, we've seen that the U.S. is willing to help the Saudi and UAE-led coalition at all costs, even while knowing that this attack essentially is a deliberate use of starvation as a weapon, which we know is a war crime under humanitarian law. You know, right now, there have been 6 days of fighting inside the city. Thousands of people who have the means to flee have fled. Many more people, of course, are not able to flee. The fighting has been intense. We know that there are French special forces on the ground helping the Emiratis and the Saudis, and of course, all sorts of mercenaries from various countries. But this is very disturbing, because so many more people are going to be affected if there's any kind of disruption to the aid that's coming in through Hodeidah.
Shireen, I'm certain that there are millions of Americans who know little or nothing about the war in Yemen. Why is this important? Why should Americans care about this conflict so far away?
I think anybody who cares about justice would care about this issue. Again, this is not a call for intervention. This is the very opposite of it. We don't want to spend taxpayer money on creating these conditions. I'm calling for the U.S. to stop its intervention in Yemen, to leave people alone, let it be. This civil war had nothing to do with the United States, and it would have never escalated to this degree had we not been involved in it. So there are so many issues at home that we have to worry about. Why should we spend all this time and energy and commit war crimes to help our allies, Saudi Arabia, when this has nothing to do with us? So I hope that people would care enough about that just to pick up the phone and say, we should not be involved in Yemen.
That was Shireen Al-Adami, Assistant Professor of Education at Michigan State University, who's originally from Yemen. Learn more about the ongoing war in Yemen and the humanitarian crisis there by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Ruling against a Trump Justice Department lawsuit, a federal judge approved the merger between AT&T and Time Warner on June 11th. The $85 billion deal will bring together two of the nation's largest media companies with complementary assets, one that produces content and the other which distributes content. AT&T, the world's largest telecommunications company, will now be joined by Time Warner's TV networks, including HBO, TBS, TNT, CNN, the Cartoon Network, Turner Classic Movies, and the Warner Brothers Movie and Television Studios. There were suspicions that the Justice Department's effort to block the merger was in part motivated by Donald Trump's anger at CNN over the news network's coverage of his presidency, a charge denied by administration officials. There are fears that the new larger AT&T will now use its market power to favor online content and video services it owns, a scenario made more likely by the FCC's recent repeal of net neutrality protections for consumers. Your reporter spoke with Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy and Communications with the media democracy group Free Press. Here he takes a critical look at what the AT&T-Time Warner merger will mean for consumers and the danger inherent in the increasing consolidation of media ownership.
Well, this is part of a new wave of media consolidation that really was triggered many years ago when Comcast bought NBC Universal. What we're seeing with Comcast NBC, what we're now seeing with AT&T Time Warner, is a merger of different types of media companies. You have very large distribution companies like Comcast, which has is the largest cable internet provider in the country, and AT&T is not far behind in terms of their internet services. They're buying up content properties. NBC Universal has a number of television and cable stations, movie production studios, and the like. The same is true with many regards with Time Warner, which owns HBO and CNN. So you have distribution companies taking over content creation companies, content production companies, and you're creating what are called massive vertically integrated media companies that control distribution as well as creation of content. And there are a number of reasons to be concerned about that. Primarily, one of the concerns that Free Press has is that these companies, now that they control distribution via our high-speed internet and content creation, have even more of an inclination to prioritize information over the internet, to violate what's called net neutrality, the principle that allows internet users to choose what they want to watch and where they want to go online. That rule was done away by the Trump administration, and these companies are now merging in this way that will allow them to push certain types of content and services over their high-speed internet connections, and conversely, to slow down or block your ability to access other services that they may not own.
Tim, I wanted to ask you about the issue of political speech. There's certainly a lot of concern about the control these larger and larger companies have over consumer pricing. But as citizens, we're concerned about access to dissenting points of view or points of view that don't quite match up with the corporate view of the world. What is the concern about political speech here, if any?
Looking over the last couple of years, you have to understand how important the internet has become as an organizing tool for social justice, racial justice movement. The movement like Black Lives Matter relied very heavily on the internet in order to get their message out. When there was an uprising in Ferguson in the wake of a police shooting there, the mainstream media was not paying a lot of attention to what was happening on the streets there. But people who were in racial justice movements, people who were on the streets there, were very effectively using online tools to get their message out, to get around mainstream news coverage to an extent that it became so large in social networks and in alternative online media that the mainstream media could no longer ignore it. So an open internet is the reason that they were successful. If we have a scenario, which we do have now, again, the net neutrality rules that we had in place were repealed and taken away on June 11th of this year, where a company, internet access provider, who doesn't like your political message could block access to those websites without any real recourse under the law. We have lost the legal protection that would prevent these large internet service providers from blocking access to content. So I think there's reason to be very concerned, not only on the economic front, as you mentioned, the cost to consumers, but also potentially the stifling of political speech, the stifling of political organizing, making it more and more difficult for people to use the open internet as a tool for organizing.
I've recently read that we're down to about six major companies that dominate all sectors of the media industry. And maybe you can express to us if there's any hope that this trend of media consolidation can be reversed or at least slowed down.
Well, I mean, we once relied upon the Federal Communications Commission to oversee media consolidation, to try to limit it. What we're seeing is a point where we may need to look not so much at the FCC, but at the FTC, the Department of Justice, and see whether there's a case to be made for antitrust. Are these companies getting so powerful and so monopoly-minded that it would trigger antitrust concerns, so that a company like a Google or a Facebook might need to be broken up because it's amassed so much. I mean, obviously, we also should look at things like AT&T and what it's trying to do and what Comcast is trying to do in consolidating. So there is mechanisms to push back against this type of consolidation. At the moment, we are fighting a lot of these types of mergers at the FCC, but we've also, you know, they're also the Department of Justice. So you're seeing a moment where a lot of these companies feel like they have an opportunity. I mean, who knows how long President Trump and his administration will be around, that we need to seize the moment. Comcast is pushing for to buy Fox Television. So we're seeing a lot of merger business happening during this administration. So one of the things that could change this wave of media consolidation is a new administration that is less open to letting very large and powerful corporations have their way.
That was Timothy Carr, Senior Director of Strategy and Communications with the media democracy group Free Press. Learn more about the efforts to democratize U.S. media by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. From mid-May to mid-June, an indigenous woman completed her eighth Water is Life walk from the source of the Housatonic River in western Massachusetts to the river's mouth in Stratford, Connecticut, at Long Island Sound. Carol Buber-Blodgett, who goes by the name of Spirit Hawk, translated from Lakota, traces her matriarchal lineage through the Penobscot Nation and belongs to the defined out-of-existence band of the Penobscot people. She says, like many who have been assimilated, it's very difficult to prove lineage when you're trying to hide your children from boarding school and you try to hide their heritage in order to do that. Spirit Hawk is an adopted Lakota from the Sikonju band and follows the Lakota Sundance way of life. On her hike, Buber-Blodgett stopped at many places along the river, including dams, which she says have heavily damaged the riverine ecosystem, where she said prayers and fed the river with handfuls of wild rice, cornmeal, cranberries, and tobacco, each signifying a staple of indigenous culture. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus participated in the walk for 3 days through northwest Connecticut, in the hills of the Berkshires, where signs were posted everywhere not to eat the fish or even step in the water due to contamination by PCBs dumped years ago into the water by General Electric from its plant in Pittsfield near the source of the Housatonic. What follows is an excerpt from a longer interview with Buber-Blodgett, conducted on the banks of the Housatonic River.
The shortest river I've done was the Quinebaug River, and that's the watershed that my grandchildren and I live in.
And that's in what state?
Connecticut and Massachusetts. And so it's a 72-mile river with 18 dams. Dams are very destructive to our waterways because they obstruct the flow, the natural flow of water. The cleansing process of the water, the way the water cycle works is everything flows to the ocean. Deep within the ocean are places where that water is sucked down under and kept underground for years and years and years before it comes up through our aquifer, up through our artesian wells and our springs. So we can't have healthy rivers. So to make that a little bit easier to understand, if the doctor told you you had 18 clots in your left leg, but don't worry, they've been there a long time, I don't think there's many people who would be very excited about the fact that they had 18 clots in their leg. And it's the same thing. These rivers are the blood veins of Mother Earth. And so we need to see her as a living being, and that those waters flow through her the same way our blood flows through us. And so she can't be healthy if we continue to obstruct the flow of her waters. And then the longest I did was the Cheyenne River, probably physically the most difficult walk, absolutely beautiful. but challenging, physically challenging because of the terrain.
In the few days that I've spent with you, I would say the one lesson that I've gotten loud and clear is unity. And you've talked about this in different ways a lot of times. And I'd like you to just talk about, you know, what you see as some of the problems and what you see as maybe the solution.
First and foremost, over the 7 years of me walking the water, it has become very clear to me that the real problem with our water is not all the companies dumping things in the river. It's not all the runoff from the agricultural departments. It's not the sewer treatment plants right along the side of the river that when you get a heavy rainfall, the ponds will fill up and it just spills into the water. All of those things contribute, but the real problem is our lack of connection to the water. We have forgotten that water is our source of life. We see it only as a resource now to be bought and sold. And we think nothing of going in and buying a bottle of water any more than we would think to go and buy a bottle of milk. Water is our source of life. Without it, we can't live. And we need to pick up that understanding that it's our source again. When we do that, water is trying to teach us so many lessons, but the number one lesson that it's trying to teach us is to come together. If you go to a confluence and you see the two rivers coming together, mingling together, they're not fighting over, this is my territory, that's your territory. They just come together and they just start to meld together right along the edge and just blend together. There's no get over, this is my space, which is what we see in our everyday life here. If I take a glass of water and I pour a few drops of my glass of water into your glass of water, there's no way that you can tell me what was your water and I can tell you what was my water. And water just comes together and it's instantly one. It moves and flows as one. That's what we as a human family need to learn to do. We need to erase the lines that we use to separate ourselves. This is all faiths, all people, one prayer for our water. It doesn't matter what religion you are or that you're no religion. It doesn't matter how old you are, how young you are, what sex you are, what color you are. Trees are trees. They come in many different sizes and shapes. End of the day, a tree is a tree. End of the day, we're all a human family. We're all human beings. That's it. We need to come back as one human family. And then we can get the rhythm of the earth back where she needs to be and live in harmony with her. And until we do begin to live in harmony with her, we're just going to suffer more and more from the increased storms and the severity of these storms, floods, tornadoes, hurricanes. We just have to find the balance again. And water is life, but it's even more than that. We are the water, and the water is us. It birthed us, and so honor that source from where you came. It's going to give and give and give. It even gives to the ones who pollute it the most. It never holds back its love, and so give it the love that it gives you.
That was Carol Boober Blodgett, an Indigenous woman who's undertaken 8 sacred water walks to reconnect with our source. Learn more about the sacred water walks by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WLSL in St. Leo, Florida, KDNK in Carbondale, Colorado, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Let's now hear from a spokesman for the Tennessee Tea Party. This group attempted to remove references of American slavery and the fact that the vast majority of the country's founders were long-standing slave owners from school textbooks. My name is Hal Rounds, R-O-U-N-D-S, like 45 caliber rounds. I teach the Constitution coast to coast for tea parties. History textbooks contain an awful lot of made-up criticism about, for instance, the founders intruding on the Indians or having slaves or being hypocrites in one way or another. The thing we need to focus on about the founders is that, given the social structure of their time, they were revolutionaries who brought liberty into a world where it hadn't existed to everybody. Not all equally instantly, but it was their progress that we need to look at. Interesting to see and good to know that esteemed historians like Jan Lewis from Rutgers University, who's typical of the centurion standing guard over the status quo, and batshit crazy teabaggers, agree on the contextualization of the terrorism that was American slavery for almost 400 years. Richard Pryor also offers some insight on the contextualization of American slavery. Niggas be holding their dicks, Jack, and white people go, why you guys holding your things? Say you done took everything else, motherfucker. Unfortunately, as civilization followed the sun, many were blinded by the light. Slavery for us is defined by two concepts. One is straightforward economics, and the other has to do with flesh, blood, and terror, not the usual framing of American slavery that exists in the abstract. First, the economic definition, the imperialist conversion of humans into instruments for the production of goods. With this definition, slavery is a practical exercise in the commercial world, similar to any capitalist endeavor, cheap labor, very cheap labor, coupled with the distribution of product.
At the time, it was perfectly legal, morally acceptable, and great for business. What a windfall. You get your workforce for free. Jesus, the good old days. In fact, guys like James Madison jumped all over this great opportunity, boasting to a British friend that he made about $257 a year on every Negro slave he owned, and he only had to spend about 13 bucks on his keep. Other founding fathers took a real hands-on approach with their slaves, like old hothead Patrick Henry and his good buddy, signer of the Declaration of Independence, Richard Henry Lee, both of whom actively traded and whipped their slaves. These guys were really involved. They took pride in their small business ownership. Also, it's encouraging when the boss visits. Employees yearn to have their hard work affirmed. No defender of slavery, I concede that it has its benevolent aspects in lifting the Negro from savagery, in helping prepare him for that eventual freedom which is surely written in the book of fate, Thomas Jefferson. The second definition centers on slavery as physical and psychological terrorism, perpetrated not by, as history would have us believe, munificent and caring paternal white father figures like Jefferson, with his hope of civilizing these savages, savages that Jefferson had no problem fucking and fathering children by, but rather perpetrated by psychotic purveyors of violence for profit, who were then exonerated by scribes, then and now, absolved of any real crimes. It's just another classic case in the history of mankind of when the power elites make the unthinkable normal. They blame everything on us, but nerve enough to even blame slavery on us. They said, we didn't bring them over here. We went to Africa to get some elephants. Niggers just jumped in the boat, the ship. Take me, take me. Nigger, we don't want you. Get back, boy. And come on, take me, take me. All right, boy, we'll take you. What else you want to do? Put a chain on my leg so I don't slip off. Comedian Dick Gregory. The myth remains safe in the whitewash of history. Not only pardons these scoundrels for crimes against humanity, it actually vindicates their evil actions. If the reality were actually contemplated to its core, the force of this terror would shake every foundation this nation rests on. One would be forced to come face to face with a reality that would include the following highlights. The theft of human beings from their home, mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, husbands, wives, who were then shackled and transported on slave ships, that can only be described as beyond shocking, where conditions would make a maggot vomit, pure and unadulterated horror. When this journey through hell ended on the pristine shores of America, these so-called animal savages, in reality, the brave and resilient human beings lucky enough not to have been clubbed to death and tossed in the Atlantic, then began the multi-generational nightmare of misery and anguish, human bondage, bought and sold away from your family on a master's whim, whippings, beatings, bludgeoning, vicious rapes, tarring and feathering, castration, the removal of limbs for what were called minor infractions, forced to fight human cockfights, hangings, more hangings, and of course, executions on demand. And then you wake up the next day and do it all over again. Now, in case we forget the real and lasting terrorism of slavery, let's add the psychological hell to the physical hell. W.E.B. Du Bois was one of the most prolific advocates of exposing the long-term psychological toll caused by slavery and its monstrous practices. Practices like selective breeding, which helped to ensure that the master had an ongoing supply of strong slaves capable of performing superhuman feats. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane. No, it's Superman Dingo. The sheer terrorism that was American slavery is another clear-cut horror that runs unbridled through American history, responsible for devastating an incalculable number of families, their structure and value debased and obliterated,
well into the future, into the present. This befouling and malignant behavior begs the rhetorical question. What was the base motivation to terrorize a people for centuries? W. E. Burghardt Du Bois reminds us once again, for it can never be overstated. Both Europe and the earlier colonists themselves regarded this land as existing chiefly for the benefit of Europe and as designed to be exploited as rapidly and ruthlessly as possible of the boundless wealth of its resources. This was the primary excuse for the rise of the African slave trade to America. W.E.B. Du Bois. You've been listening to an excerpt from Murder Incorporated, Book 1, Dreaming of Empire, by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Stephen Vittoria. When we mention Martin Luther King's name today, the image arises of his I Have a Dream speech in Washington, D.C., which has been replayed by media more than any other. By the time of his assassination, he had moved quite a way past that speech, condemning U.S. militarism, racism, capitalism, and poverty. His uncompleted work was his call for a poor people's campaign designed to appeal to all of the impoverished across America, black, white, Latino, Native American, and Asian. King, by embracing poor people, had grown beyond a black leader and beyond civil rights to the ideals advocated by Malcolm X, human rights. Among the demands of the campaign, a guaranteed income for all. King's assassination on April 4th, 1968 took the most gifted activist off the board, and with it, much of the energy behind the campaign. Until now. Today, 50 years after King's assassination, activists have emerged to rekindle his dream of a poor people's campaign. Across America, local and national voices are organizing, trying to bring King's dream to life. Activist scholars Reverend William Barber and Dr. Liz Fiohares are calling for a Poor People's Campaign for this new century. The Poor People's Campaign and the Institute for Policy Studies have just produced a new report called The Souls of Poor Folk, inspired by the classic work by W.E.B. Du Bois, The Souls of Black Folk. The report links impoverishment, systemic racism, attacks on voting rights, attacks on the environment itself, and the war economy to reveal America's war on the poor. Reverends Barber and Theo Harris call for 40 days of protests to put teeth into the campaign, one that calls for nonviolent actions all across the nation. They're calling for nothing less than the resurgence of mass movements to challenge what King opposed in his last year of life: poverty, systemic racism, rampant militarism, and capitalism and its effects on global climate systems. King would be proud. For more information, contact Pennsylvania / poorpeoplescampaign.org. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
How has the Canadian Council of Chief Executives influenced federal government policy? Is there a revolving door between Canadian government ministries and elite sectors of the economy? What is the Canadian Global Affairs Institute and what role is it playing in directing Canadian foreign policy? How big a factor is the U.S. in determining Canada's stance on Venezuela and other countries? Is financial security for seniors coming at the expense of the public good? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we probe the agency of Canada's elected politicians and the extent to which unelected entities have taken control of governance of the country. We'll hear from writer and researcher Morgan Ducheney about a group formerly called the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. We'll hear from author Eve Engler about what drives Canadian foreign policy. And we'll hear from Canadian Union of Public Employees research officer Kevin Skerritt about how Canadian pension fund investments are fostering privatization of public assets. On this week's program, Canada's secret government. Who is the power behind the throne? Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 22nd, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the home of land of the Métis and the traditional territory of the Nihiyawak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The latest statistics released by the U.S. Treasury Department showed that in April, Russia had only $48.7 billion in American assets, falling all the way to 22nd place on the list of major foreign holders of Treasury securities. Russia sold off $47.4 billion out of the $96.1 billion the country had in U.S. Treasury bonds in March. It sold literally half its holdings of U.S. dollars in just 1 month. That's what happens when you sanction countries. You strategically force them into financially defensive moves. And because a looming trade war has been threatened for some months now, warning shots from China and Japan have also been fired. That comes from the article, U.S. dollar sell-off continues as trade wars intensify, posted June 22nd, originally appearing at True Publica. Trump's hard right base imagines hordes of greedy, poorly educated workers eager to steal our well-deserved prosperity. Unfortunately, amidst the justifiable horror evoked by U.S. authorities' criminal treatment of these children, there is too little examination of the conditions that spur many of these mass migrations. Nor is this an accident. U.S. policy has played a major role in fostering or sustaining the violence that impels many to flee. Admitting that role by implication challenges the legitimacy of those policies. That comes from the article, Look Deeper, Child Detention and the U.S.'s Paramilitary Politics Abroad, by Dr. John Buell, posted June 22nd, originally appearing at Informed Comment. Under Trump, 5 bombs are dropped per hour, every hour of every day. That averages out to a bomb every 12 minutes. And which is more outrageous, the crazy amount of death and destruction we are creating around the world, or the fact that your mainstream corporate media basically never investigates it? They talk about Trump's flaws. They say he's a racist, bulbous-headed, self-centered idiot, which is totally accurate. But they don't criticize the perpetual Amityville massacre our military perpetrates by dropping a bomb every 12 minutes, most of them killing 98% non-targets. That comes from the article, Trump's Military Drops a Bomb Every 12 Minutes and No One is Talking About It, by Lee Camp, posted June 21st, originally appearing at Truthdig. As the debate swarms over illegal immigration, Americans on both the left and the right are at each other's throats, pointing fingers over who's responsible. In the meantime, what was a conspiracy theory a month ago is now being confirmed by the very people accused of keeping people in cages. One question, however, has just been raised, which gives one a dark and sickly feeling inside when thinking about the potential answers to it. Where are the girls? There's something particularly disturbing about the minuscule amount of footage recently released by HHS last week. It only shows boys, and only boys aged 10 and up. That comes from the article, Where Are the Girls? Child Trafficking Feared as DHS Can't Say Where Immigrant Girls Are Being Held, by Matt Agorist, post June 21st, originally appearing at thefreethoughtproject.com. During his meeting with NATO Secretary Jens Stoltenberg in Rome, Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte pointed out the centrality of the enlarged Mediterranean for European security, now threatened by the arc of instability stretching from the Mediterranean to the Middle East, which is why it is important for NATO, an alliance under U.S. command, which Conte describes as the, quote, pillar of interior and international security, unquote. This is a complete inversion of reality. It is the foundation of USA-NATO strategy, which in fact provoked the arc of instability with its 2 wars against Iraq, the 2 other wars which demolished the states of Yugoslavia and Libya, and the war aimed at demolishing the state of Syria. According to Conte, Italy, which participated in all these wars, plays, quote, a key role for the security and the stability of the southern flank of the alliance, unquote. That comes from the article under the headline Video, The Circuit of Death in the Enlarged Mediterranean, by Manlio Di Nucci, posted June 21st, originally appearing at Il Manifesto. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. We often hear about the American deep state or secret government undermining the will of the electorate and influencing policy in ways that favor for-profit interests. We rarely hear about a Canadian deep state. Are there power players driving the decision-making in Ottawa behind the scenes? One candidate for the role of power behind the throne is the Business Council of Canada, formerly known as the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. While not having much of a public presence, it is reputed to have unparalleled influence over the Prime Minister's office and key members of Parliament. Morgan Ducheney is an Ottawa-based freelance writer and martial arts instructor. His articles appear on the site honeybadgerpress.ca. He's also a frequent contributor to the Victoria Standard. Several years ago, he started researching the CCCE and in 2011 wrote an article, The Canadian Council of Chief Executives, Northern Oligarchy, which examines the influence of this body on Canadian governments, both liberal and conservative. Morgan joins us now by phone. Thank you for joining us, Morgan.
You're welcome.
What can you tell us about the origins of this group?
Well, the Business Council on National Issues, as it was originally called, has its origins in Canada in the early 1980s, as the large number of executives got together under the leadership of a man named Thomas D'Aquino, and they decided that they would organize themselves into a unique corporate lobby group of all of the CEOs of the dominant corporations in Canada, mainly branch plants of U.S. corporations, with the stated purpose of having a positive influence on government policy to make Canada more competitive, as they like to say, driving innovation. And this was the idea. And the Prime Minister of the day, Chrétien, publicly bemoaned their power at the same time that he was, agreeing to do whatever it was they wanted. He publicly bemoaned their influence and how his hands were tied in terms of political funding and on and on. They still exist. They've gone through a couple of name changes. They changed later to the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. Now, as you mentioned in your introduction, the Canadian Business Council. But, the idea is the same.
Could you explain what distinguishes them from other corporate lobbyists that have been around since time immemorial?
Well, because they represent the dominant corporations in Canada, they represent what Noam Chomsky would call the people who own the country, who own the businesses, who own the newspapers, the magazines, the television, radio stations, the internet service companies. They have international reach. They employ collectively probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Canadians, in spite of, the corporate tax rate dropping dramatically over the last 30 years. They contribute to the tax base. They have global influence, and many of the top actors enjoy what's been called a revolving door privilege, where they shift from the top levels of government back to business, and then it just revolves around and around and around. The commissioner of lobbyists has a discretionary power to waive the 5-year cooling off period, and often does.
Well, it's interesting you talk. It's interesting you talk about that revolving door, because the current head of the Business Council is John Manley, a former deputy prime minister under Jean Chrétien.
Oh yeah.
And you pointed out in a more recent article that former cabinet ministers John McCallum and Joe Oliver had previously held senior positions within the banking and financial sector.
Oh, yes.
And the former Alberta Premier, Jim Prentice, had assumed an executive banking position after leaving.
Almost immediately.
Yeah.
John Baird as well, Harper's foreign minister.
So how do you see that revolving door aspect of political and corporate engagement affecting democracy in Canada?
Well, I've given it a lot of thought, and I think the current state, the reality of the revolving door system, means that we're attracting to political life individuals with a particular ambition, which is less for public service and more for, it seems, personal gain, where, because they know at the end of their political careers, if they don't get a modest pension out of it after 6 years, they will want to go to work, highly paid work, banking on the influence and the insider knowledge that they've developed over their time in office. And so perhaps their behavior in politics is designed to create a favorable impression for those they wish to work for in the future. And I remember asking former Ontario Premier Mike Harris if any of his laws had assisted with his acquiring corporate directorships, and he was angry, and he actually threatened to sue me for libel.
Really?
So I'm asking you a question. Could there be a connection? Of course there's a connection. Yes, and that's the problem. So we don't have people who are entering public service, who are running for office, who want to simply serve, without looking to the future. And maybe that means better pensions, better protection for people so they won't have to worry about the future. But the current system seems to attract people who want to make it pay, and pay really well, post-politics.
Seems like a structural flaw in the system.
Yes.
Now, I notice, looking at the board of directors, the current board of directors, one of them is a Paul Desmarais Jr.,
right,
who's a past chair and sits on the business council. His father, Paul Desmarais of Power Corporation, is reputed to have had direct ties with several high-profile politicians, including former Prime Ministers Trudeau, Chrétien, Mulroney, and Paul Martin.
Oh, definitely.
Do you have any thoughts about whether the Desmarais family and Power Corporation hold some sort of unique influence over Canadian policy?
Well, the fact that they've maintained consistent close ties with a succession of prime ministers indicates that they must have a consistent level of influence, and the presence of these individuals on these boards is no accident. I know that Paul Martin originally worked for Power Corporation as a young man, and Paul Desmarais Sr. was instrumental in getting him started in the shipping business before he entered politics. It's a favor, and I'm sure Paul Martin didn't forget that. And I suppose that's how it's done. It's a game of, as Chrétien said, in his way, in his fake folksy way, some guys some guys you don't. And yes, they've maintained consistent ties with a succession of prime ministers, and conversely, you could argue that, well, they that's very wise for their business interests, and but the real question for me is why couldn't an ordinary person maintain consistent ties? Why would prime ministers be so interested in maintaining ties with such powerful people? Almost exclusively powerful people, even going so far as to marry, you know, have their children. Not necessarily arranged marriages, but you know, see that happen. I can't see it as a coincidence. I really don't think so.
Now, Morgan, I know that a few years ago, the government of Jean Chrétien introduced legislation that would eliminate corporate donations, corporate and union donations to political parties. So does this – the existence of these sorts of lobby groups with their sort of unique personal and systemic connections with government effectively make such corporate donations and financing to political parties essentially an irrelevant consideration?
Pretty much.
Really?
Yeah, if you can call the prime minister or the industry minister up and say, you know, I'd like to see you tomorrow, and boom, it happens. That's just as good, if not better, than, you know, donating, you know, $1 million to a campaign with the, you know, implied understanding that it's going to buy something, which is never admitted. It can't be admitted. But yes, I'd say it's much more effective. And it does sort of render the donation system not necessarily irrelevant, but much less important. And it provides great, although it does provide great cover, and it's another systemic or formal mechanism designed to appease as opposed to really enact any substantive change.
So let's just to nail this. Like, let's take a group, say, like the Sierra Club or the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives.
Right.
In a given year, what would their attempts to message the government, how would they compare with, a group like the Business Council of Canada?
Very poorly, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Very poorly. There's no comparison. Maybe a little bit better under Trudeau than it was under Harper. There are no figures available yet, but the access of Sierra Club's David Suzuki Foundation Greenpeace compared to not just the Canadian Business Council, or the Canadian Council on Business. God, they've changed their name so many times, I can't keep it straight. Or the Canadian Petroleum Producers Association. There's no comparison, none at all. I mean, particularly now with the events in Alberta and British Columbia, the Canadian Petroleum Producers Foundation has tremendous influence, and we see that in the recent deal. Someone was critical of the last article I wrote in the Victoria Standard, where I was talking about the billions of public dollars that are being promised to Kinder Morgan. And this sort of money, it's presented as a loan, but or as a Crown Corporation takeover temporary measure, but the record of repayment of these financial gifts is lousy. It's really, really lousy.
Could you comment on one of the aspects that has been one of the active portfolios of the Business Council of National Issues, or the CCCE, whatever you want to call it, of the council? It's not just promoting business-friendly policies like tax cuts, but promoting neoliberal trade policies, most importantly the so-called free trade agreements.
Yes. In fact, these investor rights deals.
Yeah, and
they are very, very much they're internationalists. John Manley, by his own admission, is not international. They're continentalists. They see Canada as just, they don't particularly care that much for Canadian sovereignty. They think more of North America as an entity, of course dominated by the Americans. And they would be probably quite happy to allow Canada to continue to abdicate its defense responsibilities to the United States, which incidentally we didn't have to do. At the end of World War II, Canada was a militarily dominant player in the world, and nevertheless, we see what happened. And yes, these investor rights deals, which is essentially what they are, giving foreign corporations the right to sue the Canadian government for damages if they, on our behalf, resist dangerous behavior by foreign corporations, and the Canadian Business Council is front and center on that, driving it, and they were the ones behind NAFTA, and yes, very much continentalists, and thinking of what do they call it, the freedom of capital is more important.
Okay.
Capital mobility being more important than human mobility.
In that case, when you hear the Prime Minister saying that we're going to purchase this Kinder Morgan pipeline because it's in the national interest,
right,
and yet the Business Council is saying that, well, you're effectively saying that they're putting investor rights over what most of us are accustomed to thinking of as the national interest.
Right.
You know, what do you make sense of those two propositions? This pipeline's in the national interest, but you've got a group lobbying that doesn't really care all that much about what we think of as the national interest.
Well, it's just talk.
Yeah.
It's just code. When they say that, it's done to play on the heartstrings of Canadians. It's not something that they really believe. Mm. And Kinder Morgan itself is not a particularly successful organization. They've had a lot of problems in the past, and they've been linked to Enron, and everyone knows that story. And the money, it's public money. It is not government money. It really annoys me when I hear, people, so-called professional journalists talking about government funding or government money, because it isn't. There is no such thing as government money. It's all public money. And so this project is being funded by the people of Canada.
Mm.
And
since
the talk of national interest is code.
Since you brought up the media reporting, have you noticed any changes in the way the media have been reporting on national stories since this Business Council came into being?
Well, the Business Council doesn't really get a lot of press, and I think they like it that way. Every so often, you will see an interview with John Manley, actually a little bit more over the last couple of years, but prior to that, you would see it in publications like the Report on Business or the Financial Pages of the Globe and Mail, but there wasn't a lot of front page general news coverage about the Business Council. Although John Manley was well known, he was he's a bit smoother than his predecessor, D'Aquino. He was known to be a bit abrasive and a bit more blunt. Manley, having been a politician, I think is more. A much smoother operator, and it's at least in the corporate media, what I call the corporate media. They, when you see comments by men like John Manley, it's offered with very little context. And rarely with any really articulate counterpoint. it's offered as though it's his comments are a foregone conclusion, the highest state of rational thinking, because he is who he is, and he represents who he does, and it's almost a function of the authority bias. You know, people, even though many people are very, very critical of government, yet they also have a real deference to authority and the opinions of authority, even in the face of contradictory evidence. So that's my take on that.
Okay. Well, I think we've got to leave it there, Morgan, but
sure.
I want to thank you very much for taking the time to share these perspectives
welcome.
With our listeners.
I hope it was helpful.
We've been speaking with Morgan Ducheney, Ottawa-based freelance writer and martial arts instructor. His articles appear on the site honeybadgerpress.ca.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Who's calling the shots on Canadian foreign policy on mining, militarism, and so-called humanitarian interventions? One key voice to address these questions to is frequent guest Eve Engler. Eve Engler is a Montreal-based political activist and writer specializing in dissident perspectives on Canadian foreign policy. He's been referred to as Canada's Noam Chomsky and has authored close to a dozen books over the past decade and a half, including his 2016 book, A Propaganda System, How Canada's Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation, published by Fernwood. Welcome back to the show, Eve.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you've written about a powerful player known as the Canadian Global Affairs Institute as a key mechanism for pushing foreign policy into a hawkish direction. What can you share with our listeners about who makes up this group and how it came into being?
Well, the Canadian Global Affairs Institute is a Calgary-based think tank. It's changed its name a couple years ago, but it's basically a pro-military, pro-corporate think tank set up largely with money from Frederick Mannix, who is I believe, billionaire, if not a billionaire, close to a billionaire in Calgary, that's a staunch militarist, somebody who has... He has a number of honorary colonel, a number of different regiments. And it's board of directors, has people from IAM Gold, a major Canadian mining company that's operated abroad. It's received funding from a number of different military companies like General Dynamics, Lockheed. It's received some funding from the Canadian Military Security Defense Forum, or at least some of its people have received funding from the Security Defense Forum. And, it's a one important voice in pushing the popular discussion in this country in the direction of militarism, in the direction of pro-NATO, pro-Western, pro-corporate Canadian foreign policy.
Mm. So who does the CGAI target beyond politicians?
It focuses on mostly on, produce the standard things of what think tanks do, which is producing reports, writing op-eds for media outlets, but also it's operated I guess you could call it kind of like a FLAC, media FLAC operations, where they put pressure on journalists that they didn't feel were sufficiently supportive of the military. And David Puglesi, who's the defense reporter at the Ottawa Citizen, tells a story about receiving FLAC and his editors receiving FLAC from from folks at the Canadian Global Affairs Institute over some of his writing. But they also, the Canadian Global Affairs Institute runs a program with a military studies department at the University of Calgary to train journalists in covering the Canadian military. And the objective of the program is to basically have the journalists see the military in a better light. So it's you know, that's a kind of a project that's not really about, you know, short-term aims of getting, you know, a certain idea into the media, but a more longer-term objective of shaping journalists' relationship to the Canadian military, and obviously in a direction that's you know, a more more sympathetic to the military. Certainly not in a direction that that the peace movement might want journalists to go.
Mm. Do you see any? Were there any trigger events in Canadian political life that might have forced this this CGAI and or whatever its predecessor was to boost its presence?
Kind of left unstated in a lot of this stuff is that for decades and decades the military was just nothing but positive press. And I think that the late 60s into the 70s, the anti-war movement around Vietnam, and then the peace movements of the later 70s and 80s, I think that started to have some effect. And then the scandal in the in Somalia, you know, that started weakening the military's sort of a grip over public consciousness, and Frederick Mannix is part of a number of initiatives that he's launched that were partly, I think, kind of a response to the military sort of losing a little bit of its luster. But, you know, still, you know, through these times when we talk about the death of the Canadian military, there's, you know, still the major source of federal government funding is you know, the biggest budget item line is the military, and, you know, still it's, you know, still a very powerful institution and with a massive budget, et cetera.
Hmm. Now, are there other institutions that you see as being instrumental in driving Canadian policy in a more hawkish direction?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Security Defense Forum, which is a program that exists at, I think it's High Point, it was 15 different Canadian universities, security studies programs were receiving funding. Security Defense Forum is a military body that designed to set up four decades ago to fund university programs to promote security studies, which overwhelmingly are pro-military type of thinking. And so that's an important body in terms of militarist kind of thinking. If you just take a look at, you know, like take Barrick Gold, the biggest gold mining company in the world, Canada's biggest mining company. If you look at their public relations budget department, it dwarfs all of the public relations or all of the people being paid to engage in mining justice work, for instance. So, you know, the group like Mining Watch Canada, I think, has three or four employees. Barrick Gold's public relations department's much bigger than that. Mining Association of Canada, Prospectors and Developers Association of Canada. These groups have much more money to spend on promoting Canadian global mining. And then there's, you know, 1,000 or maybe into thousands of individual smaller mining companies that usually have, you know, one person or in some cases like a gold core, not a big Vancouver-based mining company. Many people working in public relations and lobbying. If you take a look at the you know, lobbying records on at, you know, at Parliament Hill, lobbyists are, you know, supposed to register when they meet with politicians or their or their staff. And you'll find that, you know, these mining companies have, you know, many visits to these to meeting the politicians. You go into whereas, you know, again, like the mining solidarity movements, you know, it's mostly volunteer works. You know, there's a few people paid across the country to do that work, but it's overwhelmingly volunteer. You go into a different domain. You look at the question of Palestine. You'll find that you know, the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs, the main Israel lobbying organization in the country, they meet regularly with politicians. They regularly bring MPs of all parties to all expenses paid trips to Israel, and they show them a, you know, a pro-Israel kind of perspective. So when you start digging into the different domains of Canadian foreign policy, you find that the big companies, the mining companies, the military companies, and others are have infinitely more resources to fund think tanks, to fund lobbying efforts, to fund public relations. And then on top of that, of course, is that the whole media sphere, the dominant media is structured in a way to sort of serve power, and that power, you know, is generally finds itself in corporate back offices, in the Canadian military. The Canadian military, of course, we should have said this already. The Canadian military is the largest PR, has the largest PR department of any institution in this country. It's hundreds and hundreds. One estimates 660 people, I think it was, engaged in public relations for the Canadian military. I mean, the peace movement probably has, you know, one person or two people paid to engage in this kind of work. So it's the scales are very much in favor of the pro-militarist, pro-corporate perspective.
And I guess maybe just one last question I'd like to put to you. A lot of there's a tendency among a lot of people, including on the left, that a lot of the pressure on Canadian politicians is coming from the United States, a very hawkish nation and, you know, militaristic. To what extent do these organizations yield to U.S.-centric interests versus indigenous Canadian? When I say indigenous, I mean like Canadian corporate interests, if you will.
Yeah, very rarely do they yield to indigenous as an indigenous people interest.
And that's not what I meant by indigenous.
It depends. I think you got to look at different sectors. Okay, with regards to the mining sector, very important part of Canadian foreign policy is advancing the interests of Canadian mining companies in Africa, Latin America, heavily, a little bit less so in Asia. In that case, I mean, yes, the U.S. is the center of the capitalist world, and in a sense, it promotes the general capitalist interests around the world. But really, in the case of the mining, this is an entirely or an overwhelmingly Canadian-centered process. This is not about serving American mining interests. This is about serving Canadian mining interests, and Canadian corporations and wealthy Canadians are heavily invested in the mining sector, and they are far and away the world's dominant player. So that's an area where I would say it's almost nothing to do with, you know, U.S. power, U.S. lobbying. I think the military sector is more closely tied in with sort of U.S. power and the U.S. Military. I think that the U.S. does put pressure on Canada to increase military spending, and the Canadian military companies are very much tied into U.S. military companies. And the Canadian military itself, most of the recent chiefs of the defense staff have been trained, have trained in the U.S. And have fairly, you know, close ties to their American counterparts. So I think the military would be an area where sort of U.S. influence is real. It's there. The question of Palestine, the question of Israel, that's also one that there is some U.S. influence. Obviously, U.S. is a staunch pro-Israel country, has a big impact on worldwide support for Israel. But then again, there's also domestic forces that are pushing in that direction. So I think it varies. You know, you take a look at like recent months. Chrystia Freeland, Canada's foreign minister, has been staunchly opposed to the government in Venezuela, and has just been campaigning aggressively, over the top, pushing Caribbean countries to take a more anti-Venezuela position during bilateral discussions. The simplistic analysis that some say is, oh, this is just Chrystia Freeland that wants to make nice with Trump because, you know, to help in negotiations with NAFTA. I don't think that that's non-existent as a factor, but I think the fact that the whole Canadian mining sector is hostile to what they call resource nationalism, which is countries basically trying to get a bit more of the wealth being created from their natural resources. The fact that Venezuela has been viewed as at the sort of forefront of more nationalistic natural resource policy, I think that is also an important factor in explaining Chrystia Freeland's aggressiveness to the government of Venezuela. So, you know, I think each issue is there's slight differences on each one of them. Yes, U.S. policy is important, but I think also it's important to be aware that there's a whole sector of even progressive left, progressive opinion in this country that tries to sort of blame it all on the U.S. You know, the U.S. has forced us to do these bad things. And it's actually, I think, a bit more complicated than that.
We've been speaking with Yves Engler, Montreal-based political activist and writer. You can find his articles at the website yvesengler.com. The Canadian Pension Plan is considered a progressive initiative, making sure that for Canadians, retirement does not mean destitution. However, the CPP Investment Board funds projects that offer the best return on investment, regardless of social or environmental implications. Beyond this reality, pension funds generally are assisting in the privatization of a whole range of infrastructure projects, which has consequences for the public good. Joining us to discuss this subject is Kevin Skerritt. He's a research officer with the Canadian Union of Public Employees. He's co-editor and contributor to the volume The Contradictions of Pension Fund Capitalism, published by Cornell Press. He also authored an article for Canadian Dimension back in January. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour, Kevin.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
A lot of Canadians might be outraged to hear that their pension funds are invested in oil pipelines, weapons manufacturers, and other areas, and they have no choice in the matter. You can't opt out of the CPP and invest in, say, more ethical ventures even if you wanted to. But it seems that there's something unique about the way Canadian pension funds are utilized to advance infrastructure projects. What's the link between pension fund investing and privatization of infrastructure projects?
Yes, it's an excellent question. And as you say, this in this book that I was recently a part of pulling together, I have a whole chapter dedicated to this phenomenon, which I think a lot of Canadians and a lot of pension plan members, not just Canada Pension Plan, but also workplace level pension plans, and may not be aware of actually, you know, what their pension funds are doing. Of these plans have been increasingly structured to connect the pension benefit promises to financial assets in the private financial markets. And what my recent research has looked more deeply at is just exactly what does that mean. And in over the last 20 years, the argument I'm developing is that Canada's pension funds, even more so than those of other countries, have become very deeply implicated in this particular direction of investing in what used to be public infrastructure, and it has been a part of a wave of really the privatization of many different forms of public infrastructure, not just roads and bridges and some of that physical infrastructure, but also vital parts of the public sector, water systems and hospital systems and schools and many other things that a lot of Canadians and certainly a lot of public sector workers believe should be publicly owned and controlled and democratically managed. So the connection there is an important one. And the reason the funds are doing it is because they're finding attractive investment opportunities through the results of, neoliberal privatization of these various things. So there's a troubling connection here that I think needs more debate.
Hence the contradiction.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, if I'm understanding properly, when you have this courting of pension fund money, are we talking about somehow directing it in a way that it'll somehow create more investment from other sources, not just pension funds? Like priming the pump, so to speak?
I think that is – I mean, I think the actual mechanics of this investment can play out in different ways. Sometimes pension funds are one institutional source of investment alongside a number of others, and they can be relatively small or passive investors that are just joining the crowd. But the thing that I'm signaling and the work that I've been recently publishing on is showing that in certain cases, in fact many cases, pension funds, and including these large Canadian funds like CPPIB, are actually playing a leading role in directly investing in these things. That means on a private equity or direct ownership basis, they are buying up companies, they're buying up entities and projects and chunks of physical infrastructure, not just in Canada, but in other countries, including in the global south, in a way that is really, transforming the pension funds themselves into business operations, where they're going to own and operate chunks of physical infrastructure on a very peculiar for-profit basis. But for profit, but also on an untaxed basis. Pension funds are tax exempt entities, so they're developing a very peculiar private business model where they are, serving a function like a private company would, but they don't pay taxes on it, and it is having the same kind of predatory, socially regressive impact of all kinds of the privatizations that we've seen, but it is. Being given a gloss, like a relatively positive appearance, because a lot of people have positive associations with pension funds. Well, if the pension funds are involved, it must be somehow socially positive. And I think there's a lot of myths and illusions that people have that we've got to overcome.
And yeah, this goes along. I mean, for people who are critical of ownership of the means of production, well, in a sense, I mean, here you have these people who, through their pension funds, becoming owners of these private operations. I mean, you made a comparison between the Ontario Teachers' Plan support for a privatized water utility in Chile, while there's not the same degree of investment in water infrastructure for First Nations reserves. Does the requirement of the Canadian Pension Plan Investment Board having to get the best possible return on investment effectively dictate the kind of public works projects the Canadian government will have to support?
I think that zeroes right in on a key issue here, and that is, when we talk about public infrastructure, what we should be thinking about and what historically people fought for going back to the 19th century was having a certain category of goods that are recognized as being important, socially important, and even important for the economy, that the state, that government, and the public sector take responsibility for, pull it out of the private market so that it not become monopolized and can be actually part of social and economic development that can be state-led. Well, as you know, as people are familiar with over the last 30, 40 years, you know, what we crudely call neoliberal, the neoliberal revolution of Thatcher and Reagan and others have basically said, look, we're going to turn against that model and actually push a whole range of these things back into the private market. And in many cases, what this is producing is private monopolies that are transforming what were public goods into private for-profit opportunities. And one of the arguments I'm making about this, because what this is really doing is financial, it's not just privatizing, but it's financializing these public goods. The pension funds as entities, as kind of corporate business sector entities, are not just taking up opportunities that governments are providing when they privatize. They are actually becoming political actors that are lobbying and pressing and organizing governments to change public policy to produce more of these things, to actually privatize more, produce more public-private partnerships, more investment opportunities for them. So this is not just a passive role. They are actually agents, like political agents of this. They get involved in lobbying exercises. They work together, sometimes with private banks and other parts of the financial system, to actually make more of this, these opportunities happen. And a lot of this is happening, you know, in ways that are not very visible to the broad population and certainly the pension plan members. It's done very quietly. And I think this is a really troubling trajectory that we need to politicize. We need more people to understand this dynamic, and we need to actually figure out a way to push against this whole direction, because I think that what we're really talking about now, the entire public sector and public infrastructure is sort of on the table under threat. And I think this is, ironically, this is a threat not just to some of the fabric of our society, but it's actually in some ways a direct threat to, you know, the existing workers in the public sector, including the members of the pension funds that are carrying this out. So this is where the contradictions become really stark and something to really, we need to figure out how to discuss and how to challenge.
The Trudeau government announced just a couple of weeks ago it would indemnify investors taking over the Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain pipeline expansion. And the CPPIB board CEO Mark Macken signaled that the CPP was on board. And that'll come as a shock to a lot of those pipeline protesters on the West Coast. But what's the significance of the CPP rallying behind that project in the wider context you just mentioned?
This pipeline is perhaps the single most contentious infrastructural project that we've seen in recent years. And contentious for all the reasons we know, the climate change, ecologically destructive aspect. We've got Indigenous First Nations land rights at stake. There's all kinds of reasons that a lot of people are opposed to this project, and we kind of see provincial and the federal government trying to jam this through notwithstanding. So to see the Canada Pension Plan and possibly other pension funds being potentially tapped or mobilized to actually invest and help make this happen is actually a really troubling divergence from I would say the long established tradition of seeing the CPP Investment Board as a pure financial actor, not an arm or agent of the federal government, but making financial decisions separate. So that is potentially troubling if this is politicizing that board. But then the second piece of this is, you know, if the government is going to indemnify and actually create a situation where investing in this project is no risk, it's essentially indemnified, you can have an attractive rate of return with essentially no risk, then of course these pension funds, as, you know, rational profit maximizers, they're going to take up the opportunity. But then that begs deep questions about, like, what is this, and what kind of disastrous public policy is this federal government getting us drawn into, where not only are we having all of the negative downsides of this pipeline project, but we're also having to see the federal treasury, the federal budget, being tapped to subsidize and indemnify the private investors that are wanting to take advantage of this opportunity as a simple money-making exercise. So this is giving us a window into a really troubling kind of combination of public policies that I think really need far more debate and scrutiny, and we need to figure out a way to reorient not only away from fossil fuels and pipelines, but also away from having major infrastructure decisions simply being made by, as I say, profit-maximizing financial players.
Kevin Skerritt is a research officer with the Canadian Union of Public Employees and co-editor of The Contradictions of Pension Fund Capitalism, published by Cornell Press. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.